other. We need to talk to the members. They need to be present when you speak. I'll hand over to you, Chair, for the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. Chair, I don't know. Just to mention to you, I brought a team with me from the FFC, and we will spread the presentation amongst four of us, knowing that the time is limited. But we thought that if we break it up, it will go quicker. On the one end. But I also just want to let the chairperson know. So Sheng is going to present after me. And then we got Nomfundo. And then we have. Sorry, is my mic on? Nkululi doing the part of it. So it's Sheng Cheng, it's Dr. Faku, it's Dr. Ngube, and we'll pull it together. Next to me is Henry Eckstein. Next to Dr. Ngube is Dr. K. Brown, who's the CEO of the FFC, formerly from the National Treasury. And then we have Eddie Rakabe from our team. We will all shield the questions to you. Behind me, I've got Ansuya, who's the support to the commissioners, and Rista Abrams, who's the support to in my office. So, yeah, I just want to remind, if I can, that we're responding to a set of documents that the minister presented to Parliament. So on the one end is a response to the MTPBS, and the other is on the amendments to the Division of Revenue, the amendments to the appropriation, indirectly to the amendments to the estimated national expenditure, and here and there around the taxing questions. So it's quite voluminous, and I think maybe I should just remind the chair to show you this is the set of documents that was presented to Parliament, and it's going to require quite a detailed expression on how we feel about what our views are of this, because you gave us effectively you gave us 2 days to respond, and the team had to work over the weekend, and we were pushing hard on it, but we will. Trying to fulfill our duty, and hopefully after our presentation Honourable Eunice Karim will be a full-time Springbok supporter and a rugby supporter. Chair, we'll be bringing this presentation to you in quite difficult circumstances, but this presentation is based on our constitutional mandate, and we're essentially talking to you based on what the Constitution requires from us and what the money bills requires from the FFC and what the FFC Act requires from us. So we're talking to you based on the Constitution, constitutional law, and the three sets of those laws that speaks to what we want to talk to you today about. At the end of this presentation, we would like to ensure that you are aware of, and this is not on the slide, because I'm giving you the substance of the subtext of the message that we're putting to you, and we will go into the detail of it. But here's the thing: we want to ensure that you have a sense that part of our presentation is the need to reorientate public finances. Essentially, the allocations, the revenue allocations, and where priorities are located, and where policy gets made, but the priorities of financing is not following it. We also want to state to you that the protection of social spending, social protection, if you like, and the complexity in terms of how do we balance protection of social protection? That is actually social protection, education, health, welfare, and those services with the current growth and projected current and projected growth levels. So it's a tight balancing act that we're talking to you about. The third is the importance of the quest for efficiencies in the utilization of resources. And we would like you to think through this question, because cuts doesn't necessarily mean it's going to bring about efficiencies. So there's a question that we picked up between cuts in budgets and the whole question of reprioritization. And the question is then, how do these two work in the same direction as trying to create efficiencies within the system? Or not? The fourth point is the subtext of the implementation, the sluggish implementation of policy, and the whole question of indecisiveness around policy. Now, clearly the one matter that stands out is the ETOLs. You can't have two different speak on it. Pay-as-you-go speak, because of borrowing of funds or for road infrastructure, and then there's a speak of we're going to have to look at, there's no guarantees of payments, and we have to look at other options. There's only one option. If you borrowed money, you need to pay it back. So that's the key issue that needs to be looked at. And if we don't pay back on it, notwithstanding the policy decisions on it, then it means the responsibility shifts to the citizens. And linked to that is the decisions around SOEs. On the one hand, we say SOEs must be sustainable, they mustn't be dependent. We just cut the dependency issue. On the other hand, when SOEs come, we provide fiscal injections or equity injections, cash injections, and that creates problems on them. Because if you pay Paul, you need to cut the services to pay Peter. Sorry, I didn't mean to pull the religious thing there. But part of that problem is it also has eroded the and this is a serious matter. It's actually eroded the credibility and the standing of SANRAL in particular when it came to its ability to service those government guarantees. The fifth point that we're making out of this is the issue around the wage bill. Now, we're not jumping on it as in the same way as others, because we think that there's a need to firstly ensure what ought to be the size and the shape of the public service. If we know that, then we'll know exactly how much the public service is supposed to cost us at a national level, at a provincial level, at a municipal level, but also in terms of public entities. Inside of that, we have the view that we need to look at the structure of the wage bill, the different levels in particular, the executive management, the middle management, and the other staff within the public service. And then connect that to the productivity levels. So we're saying that Parliament, our advice to Parliament is that we need to be cautious as to how we interact around the public wage bill issue. Yes, it is high at the level of 46%. However, there are historic issues as to how we got to this how we got to a wage bill like this, especially with the hotspots arrangement around the 14 administrations. But we also knew that we didn't put all the administrations into one, we'd have serious problems around that. The sixth point is the fiscal reprioritization and fiscal consolidation matter that we are raising. The sixth is the debt to GDP ratio and the debt trap to it. There are issues that we're raising around fiscal credibility crisis. And here in particular, we're looking at fiscal targets and continuous shifting. We have the view that we can't have continuously different policies, economic policies. There was RDP, there was GEAR. Depending where you stand on the GEAR issue, GEAR was probably the most important economic policy at a certain time, but then afterwards all these other new policies came in, and as a result, on the one hand it creates confusion around what is the real economic policy, how do we deal with growth, because there's a continuity shift in terms of growth targets. There's the old issue around public service reduction questions, and issues around the fiscal targets. And in many ways, these has consequences for how investors sees South African society. So we're arguing that indirectly that there's an issue of consistency around policy needs to be resolved. The seventh point, I think it's the seventh point, is we want to say that there has been an element of resilience, especially at the baseline level of the of our economy. We're able to collect at least some sort of revenue that is able to help to protect social services. There are structural impediments to public investments, and investments are not always responding to what the economy requires. The issue of quality of implementation, and especially as it relates to access and quality, and how do we deal with the whole question of the triple challenges? It's one of those things that we need to deal with the stubbornness of poverty, we need to deal with the stubbornness of inequality, but we also need to find ways to effectively ensure that we see that the changes coming about in inequality within the country. We're still sitting at 0.69, close to 70, and it's still a problem. So with that as the background to our presentation, responding to the MTBBS, amendments to the Division of Revenue, amendments to the Appropriation Act, the taxing and the taxing policies presented, and also the adjustments to the estimated national expenditure. I'm quickly handing over to Sheng, and then we'll take it in a row, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next one.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. So just to go one slide back up, is that a financial quick revision here is that the Financial and Fiscal Commission is a permanent constitutional body that advises all organs of states on economic, financial, and fiscal matters. Essentially, any legislation relating to these matters as referred to in the Constitution and quotes may be enacted only after any recommendations of the Financial and Fiscal Commission have been considered, end quotes. And with that, next slide, introduction, is that this medium-term MTBPS is framed in an economic environment characterized by muted economic growth. Despite the modest, we note that rebounding of the economy in the second quarter, growth is still very fragile, with growth prospects revised downward by many institutions, domestic and international. This low and fragile growth acts as a dead weight on the country's ability to raise tax revenues. In fact, revenue collections, as we all heard, is projected to weaken further even over the medium term. And therefore, making it difficult to tackle the triple challenges, as our chairperson earlier said. The triple challenges, and really challenges, of high unemployment, poverty, and inequality. Honourable Chair, members, roughly 55%, percent of our people are officially living in poverty. And that is under the upper poverty line of just slightly more than 1,000 rand per month. Now imagine that, 1,000 rand only. And almost one in three individuals is unemployed at 29.1%, according to the latest quarterly labor force survey, which exacerbates by the 2015 estimates, as our chairperson also said, Gini coefficient is at 0.696. Now, Gini coefficient is a measure of inequality, ranging from zero being perfectly equal society to one, most unequal, utterly unequal society. So with that, next slide, is hence, the FFC has identified a list of reasons for why this economic growth is faltering in the country, particularly around inefficiencies in the way resources are used across the economy, both public and arguably private. Fiscal leakages that is pervasive across the economy, high instances of corruption and inefficiency in government procurement processes, intermittent electricity supplies and our struggles, constant struggles with the energy supply issue, and infrastructure that is inadequately built or maintained even when budgeted and planned for. Other factors include a policy and implementation uncertainty and contradicting signals in particular, affecting confidence and policy credibility, which we'll emphasize again later, such as the runaway public sector wage bill and the SOCs that continue to hemorrhage state's resources. Commissioner Goh agrees with the government in the MTPPS that higher, inclusive, and sustained growth is imperative at this juncture. Commission notes, next slide, the government initiatives launched to tackle these challenges, and it's a long list, and that we note that the candidness of the MTPPS about the current dire economic situation. This MTPPS, we recognize, it is indeed one of the toughest ones to craft as it seeks to strike the balance between resuscitating the fragile economy and protecting social spending and delivery. And we note that trade-offs is inevitable. In response to that long list of initiatives, the Commission advises that and implores the government to institutionalize these initiatives in order to make sure that this implementation is real and carry them through. Next slide. Looking at our economic outlook and public finances, South Africa's long-term economic growth prospects remain bleak, despite some feeble signs for positive improvement, data which we'll prove just now. Our message is that with the weak economy and diminishing tax base, there is no room for fiscal options in the near future, which leaves fiscal reprioritization, fiscal consolidation through restructuring and governance to be the only viable course of action to restore fiscal credibility for a sustainable future of South Africa. Next slide. This is a factor contribution to growth analysis done by the FSC model, and the focus here, Honourable Chair Members, is just the blue bar. The blue bar represents the total factor productivity as a contributing factor to growth. Essentially, total factor productivity, very quickly, it's a representation of anything that is to do with efficiency. It could include policy, implementation, institution, anything efficiency-wise, all right? And so one can argue that where a positive total factor productivity means that the economy is growing efficiently, it's operating in a healthy state, where it deteriorates, its economy growth is in trouble. So one can notice first is on the left side, we can see that near quarter three of 2011, the blue bar just collapsed, right? And showing weakening of the economic growth in terms of efficiency and all that represents by it. And the last the little circle, if I focus your attention to the right, is there's a little uptick in the latest estimates of total factor productivity together with total capital stock. So there is a slight tenuous feeble sign of positive growth in the economy. Next slide. The economy, hence, it's a mixed picture, right, with tenuous signs of recovery, but we have to work hard on it. Further, on the supply side story, or this production side story, by industries, we note that the mining and quarrying and construction industries, and also agriculture, also faced major contractions in the recent quarters due to receding demands for both international, which is exogenous, that we can't do much about, as well as with the main domestic markets that we must take ownership of. On the demand side, just to summarize, is that we note the recent pickup in both the private and government's consumption to growth. However, public investment softened slightly from 0.5 to 0.4, though maintaining its positive position. The private investment, though, has remained in the negative territory at negative 0.3%. And of note here is that inventories increased by 0.7% in the latest quarter. Potentially, Honourable Chair Members, it means that basically the economy is restocking, all right, potentially indicating a potential uptick in the demand in the very, very near future. However, with all this both supply and demand side story, government's role, our role, is to continue taking bold, informed steps to eliminate inefficiencies and policy and implementation uncertainties in public institutions. As these inefficiencies, uncertainties have become endemic due to the fiscal leakages, dysfunctional states, SOCs, and ineffective implementing agents. Next slide. Honourable Chair Members, we focus on investment because it is critical for future growth relative to current growth and consumption. Therefore, we present you this graph focusing on the private investments. Now, private investment in machinery and equipment, which is vital to production of goods and services in future supply, remains muted. As you can see there in the last quarter, in quarter two of 2019, it's in the negative region. But the private investment in construction in particular suffered major declines in the recent quarters as concerns over demand and future growth prospects remain present. And just think of it logically is that it depresses building more structures and to accommodate businesses and households. In sum then, just to reiterate, is that the economy, it's a mixed bag with feeble signs of recovery as factors of productivity and capital stock strengthened, as we presented earlier. However, but the investment of equipment, construction for future growth or indicating its weakening. Next slide. Moving on to the anatomy of fiscal crisis, which is what I look at the nature of this, is that the FFC notes that during the post-2008-09 financial crisis, government revenue and expenditure trends have diverged significantly as fiscal position with a focus on social functions and education, social development and health were affected. However, these prioritized investments funded by fiscal expansion did not yield the anticipated social economic results and outcomes as the triple challenges of poverty, inequality and unemployment deepened with low growth. Meanwhile, governance failures and fiscal leakages persist. So, the Commission has noted that despite the recent fiscal consolidation announcements, years of it, total expenditure have remained far higher than total revenue, resulting in a continued deterioration of the cash book balance, basically deficit, but in real hard cash now, and the rising debt position. Next slide. This graph just presents that widening gap. If I may focus your attention to the blue line, which is revenue, and red line for expenditure, the widening gap between the red and blue lines on this graph, as well as the cash book balance, the green dotted line, reading from the right axis, is deteriorating, as well as note how the expenditure of interest, that is the debt service cost that we've heard so much of, the blue dotted line is increasing, and not only increasing, but increasing at an increasing rate. Right. Next slide. So the widening fiscal gap, which we presented in the previous graph, between revenue and expenditure, gave rise to the increasing debt position as this gross loan debt. The story of fiscal deficit and debt is well documented in the MPPPS. The Commission, though, in this particular graph, wishes to focus, Honourable All, to the green area of the graph, which is widening as financial guarantees. Okay, next slide. Honourable Chair Members, the key words we would like to deliver here today are fiscal reprioritization, fiscal consolidation, and most importantly, fiscal credibility. First of all, fiscal reprioritization and consolidation, the FFC believes that government must take bold, decisive, and immediate actions to deepen its fiscal consolidation and reprioritization commitments through restructuring and governance reform to return South Africa to a sustainable fiscal path. Plans should be made for non-essential programs, entities, and implementing agents to be rationalized with its productive capacity redeployed to growth priority functions to get us out of this low growth trap. On the issue of debt to GDP ratio, the Commission's position is that there is no universal debt to GDP threshold that is in keeping with the South African context, or any country context in for that matter. However, for the Commission, the debt incurred through public finances must be used for investing in productive growth activities only, with guaranteed future economic returns higher than the cost of debt or debt service costs. We therefore advise that a fiscal rule for borrowing in terms of quantum, composition, and usage must be considered. Next slide. Lastly, the fiscal credibility crisis, admittedly, the Commission notes that year after year, actual rates of economic growth and revenue collection have consistently been failed to reach its projected targets. More specifically, notwithstanding the direct costs, that's something that we can easily see, of adding to the fiscal deficit as a result of overestimating tax revenue and lower expenditure, the Commission, though, is concerned over the indirect costs, in particular, on fiscal credibility, rendering policies and implementations ineffective, as well as the dead weight loss in disruptions to planning and execution of adjustments caused by, obviously, failing to reach these fiscal targets. The government essentially is losing its grip on the fiscal handles due to the policy to this fiscal credibility crisis, rendering policies ineffective, leading to a potential policy paralysis. Therefore, the Commission advises that approach be adopted in extrapolating trajectories of economic growth and collection of fiscal revenue, and that the budget for spending is determined accordingly under a ceiling for expenditure with the fiscal borrowing rule, which we advised in the last slide. So, main messages or keywords are fiscal reprioritization, fiscal consolidation, and fiscal credibility. The Commission also had a reflected on the National Treasury's economic strategy for South Africa. The next slide. The Commission cautions against that policy incrementalism that translates into resource wastage. The economic strategy should have commenced with a policy diagnostic analysis to inform reasons why previous interventions have failed, thereby restoring their fiscal credibility. The strategy, some of the weaknesses are that the strategy does not explicitly discuss township economies, which is very prevalent in South Africa, equates rurality or assume that there is that correlation between rurality and agriculture, and supports for the informal sector. It lacks specific details regarding some strategic interventions that are of importance for economic revival. The strategy does not clearly articulate the role and impact of institutions in key sectors. Earlier points about institutionalizing those initiatives to ensure that they stick. The Commission recommends the strengthening of the administrative capacity of the states for successful policy implementation. Now, I will hand over to Dr. Vakul.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I will take you through the next few slides, starting with the overview of the 2019 fiscal framework. The Commission notes that the depressed economic situation that my colleague has just explained imposes constraints to the broader fiscal framework. Over the 2020 MTEF, government is expected to spend about 5.7 trillion and the revenue is less than that. We only have 4.6 trillion for this period. And then also for the 2019-20 financial year, growth is expected to growth on expenditure is expected to be higher than the growth on revenue. Moving on to the MTF division of revenue amongst the three spheres, We note that there's been a nominal increase in terms of the allocation, but a real annual average growth rate of negative 0.5 is projected, and this is mainly driven by the allocations. This is mainly driven by the allocations to the national government. We also note that the allocations for the local government and provincial sphere has been prioritized due to the importance of certain services such as education, health, and municipal basic services. Next slide. Now we're looking at consolidated government expenditure by economic classification. The Commission notes the implementation of the measures to contain the wage bill, which were announced in the MTPPS, for example, the freezing of salaries, but is of the view that the initiative should be extended to state-owned entities and local government. Also, previously, the Commission has advised that wage increases should be closely linked to productivity. The Commission notes that there is a slow growth in terms of capital investment, which does not commensurate with the government's plans of infrastructure-led growth, as well as the government initiatives that are meant to grow the economy. There's also the issue of growth in goods and services, which is declining, and this could mean that the cost containment measures are working, or it may have a negative effect on social services. Moving on to next slide. Moving on to revenue and tax proposal. What we should note here is that there is a projected revenue shortfall, and for the year 2019-20, the projection is of 52.5 billion. For the following year, it's 84 billion, and for 2021-22, it's 114.7 billion. This warrants a sustained increase in required economic growth and unemployment to improve revenue collection for the government to be able to meet the socio-economic objectives. And I just want to highlight that the scope for government to increase revenues by raising taxes is becoming smaller because tax hikes are likely to have a negative impact on the economic performance, hence on revenue collection as consumers
just,
are forced.
Just a second, ma'am. Can you please just give a distance between your mouth and the mic? We're struggling to hear some of the words.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, let's move to the next slide. Also, this slide looks at the review of the actual spending for the year 2019-20. So there we see that the total government spending by between April and September of 2019-20 was at 40%, and spending by all votes was also at 48%, but transfers of the equitable share was at 50% as expected. Looking at individual departments such as higher education and training, the spending was at 71%, and for basic education is at 58.5%. And there are also other departments where the spending was quite low, below 40%. And the Commission is of the view that unless the departments on their annual plans explicitly identify unusual spending, excessive deviation below and above average are generally perceived as undesirable from the perspective of planning and execution. Next slide, please. Now we're looking at the revised division of revenue, and we see that there has been an increase in the declared unspent funds that are being returned to the fiscus. This has
increased from 329 million in 2018 to 3.9 billion in 2019-20. And a larger share of this is from the Department of Higher Education and Training and the Department of Health. So the Commission is concerned about the unspent fund on these programs as they are important. And the projected underspending for the national government is estimated to be 1.1 billion, which is a decline from 2.7 billion from 2018-19. And rollovers that are registered for the Department of Water and Sanitation, Department of Health, they account for 96% of the total rollovers of 344.9 million. And the Commission would like to reiterate the importance of this department using the rollovers according to the regulations provided by the National Treasury to avoid wasteful expenditure. Next slide, please. Okay, here we're looking at the local government issues. We all know that the president has recently announced the new service delivery model, which is based on district. And this model is meant to improve coordination and planning among national, provincial, and local government. So the point that the Commission wants to make here is that this model will have implications for the 2020 MTF allocations. So there will be a need to align funds to this new approach. So the Commission welcomes the new approach and is of the view that it has the potential to improve coordination and planning among the three spheres of government. However, the Commission wants to emphasize the need for government to consider the current weaknesses in the local government, particularly in district municipalities. So those weaknesses need to be addressed before the model is implemented. For example, we have over 60% of district municipalities that are dysfunctional and are poorly capacitated. Looking at the allocations to the local government, the sphere is set to receive a total allocation of 427.7 billion, which is less by 20.5 billion from what was announced in February. We've also seen the downward revisions in terms of the percentage share that the local government receives from the nationally raised revenues. And also the increases in terms of real growth are projected. But I just want to note that for 2020-21, there will be a decline. The Commission notes the reductions, but would like to caution against the implications of these reductions on service delivery. And also, the Commission would like to advise government to at least prioritize on revenue-raising capacity. And in its 2020-21 annual submission, it has it has provided a number of alternative revenue sources that government can use. Next slide, please. Okay, this slide just shows the real growth rates for the local government equitable share allocations. And what we need to note is that over the next 3 years, the allocations are expected to grow at a decreasing rate in real terms. And the Commission welcomes the nominal increase in the allocation, but is concerned about the projected decline as they will have a negative effect on service delivery. Moving on to conditional grants to the local government. What we need to note here is that the conditional grants to the local government were also affected by the cuts. And the commission is of the view that the commission would like to see reprioritization towards the local government relative to other spheres, and is of the view that the reductions should be implemented with caution to ensure that they don't negatively affect basic services. And then the commission also emphasizes the need to look into the past performance of each grant to avoid cutting infrastructure grants that are important for service delivery and economic growth. I'd like to hand over to Dr. Ngunde. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to take you through the last few slides. The rest of the presentation is reflecting on a number of areas. We are looking at the issues of allocative efficiency, challenges and opportunities within the key priority areas of infrastructure, social services, as well as some state-owned enterprises, what is happening in state-owned enterprises. On infrastructure, we know that even our previous presentations and submissions on the annual division of revenue have emphasized the importance of infrastructure-led growth in terms of employment, creating jobs, and poverty alleviation and alleviating the challenge of inequality. And public infrastructure is very important in that particular sense, as it's meant to crowd in private investment. If public infrastructure delivery management is weak, it is not going to crowd in private investment. We know that in
Chairperson, sorry. Can the mics are not difficult to work with. If you're speaking at the mic, please, if you look away from it, then we can't hear you. So, please, we'd like to hear what you've got to say, sir.
Yeah. Infrastructure spending effects on South Africa.
Just a moment. I have said 15 minutes when the chairperson started, and after 15 minutes left, I've said another 15 minutes. So you are consumed 30 minutes already. Just bear that in mind.
Yeah, I'm going to cut some of the stuff. On infrastructure, we note that public infrastructure delivery management is very weak and holds back potential investment returns to the economy, especially from the private sector. And we are saying there is a need to build the required government capacity to manage infrastructure projects within different spheres of government. The next slide, please. We look at the social services, in particular the health sector. On that one, the Commission notes that Department of Health declared 346 million unspent funds, of which about 69% are with respect to the NHI indirect grant. The Commission is concerned, especially on the NHI issue, and also we want to take note of the statement in the budget which says, however, given the macroeconomic and fiscal outlook, the estimates to roll out NHI that were published in the NHI Green Paper and the White Paper are no longer affordable. Take note of that statement. And on higher education, we note the importance of higher education and training in terms of skills. However, the Commission is of the view that funding for higher education should be underpinned by a comprehensive, fee-free higher education policy. There is need for that particular policy. On state-owned enterprises, the most important thing to note there is the contingent liabilities, which will reach 1 trillion in 2021-22. Which constitutes almost a third of government net loan debt. Guarantees to state-owned enterprises will reach an estimated half a trillion of that. And if we look deeper into that, Eskom accounts for about 50% of total government guarantees. And also, in terms of bailouts, we see that 44.5 million is estimated to go towards that, and the bulk is actually from Eskom, accounted for Eskom about 71%, and the rest of the bailouts are estimates are indicated there. Then on the next slide. The financial health of state-owned enterprises. What we note there is the losses. You see the losses by Eskom. They account for the bulk, followed by SA. Then on the next slide, the commission decided to comment on the Eskom roadmap, which was presented by the minister quite recently. And on that one, there are three key issues we would like to mention in the next slide. That the view of the commission is that the Eskom plan is the first step in the right direction in restructuring Eskom. The commission supports this particular initiative as it is likely to enhance efficiency and cut costs. However, that plan excludes some of the details which we feel are important. The view of the commission is that there should be an analysis and comparison of the options, different options, the cost and benefits of Eskom unbundling. It must be made clear in order to evaluate the true financial and economic value of the restructuring, especially when it comes to the transition from the existing dependence on fossil fuel to the mix of electricity energy solutions. So an analysis of the cost pressures must be included in that particular plan for ease of evaluation. And the commission advises that in terms of all other SOEs, the commission advises that preconditions which were given to ESCOM must be extended to all other institutions which seek government debt relief. Then, lastly, to conclude our submission, there are key issues we would like to mention. That the economic situation, as we know, is very, very bleak. And as has been pointed out, it was a difficult MTBPS to craft. Unemployment has risen. Growth is projected to go down to 0.7%. So the economy is trapped in a precarious growth trajectory. But we emphasize that policy and implementation certainties are the cornerstone of restoring confidence and fiscal credibility. Overall, the MTBPS reflects what the Commission has been recommending in the past 10 years or so, especially around fiscal reprioritization and consolidation. And we recommend that we note that it is important that measures of reprioritizing and tightening the budget are actually carried through. There is need to rebuild government institutions and also redirect government spending towards growth and employment creation and the protection of social expenditure. The Commission supports that. The Commission recommends that a cogent review of the public sector wage is undertaken. Whilst also the Commission implores government to carry through some of the initiatives which we listed in the initial slides. And also government has to restore governance systems, especially in SOEs, and also take decisive steps to deal with SOEs whose social and economic value is negative. Government is also implored to focus and strengthen state capabilities and grow the economy in order to fight these particular three triple challenges. And with that, let me say that the overall MTBPS reflects the major sentiments of the Commission, and we support some of the initiatives within the MTBPS.
Are you done?
Yes,
you have spent exactly 38 minutes on your presentation. And now we are going to the next item, PBO. We have had a session. I see some are giving facial expressions. The agenda says we'll have discussions after both presentations. Last week we have had a session with PBO, and I want to request PBO that please you don't start afresh. It's a continuation of what you have presented, and I hope you will not spend that much time, and I will set time for you and I'll stop you. Thank you. PBO? Do you want to present from here? The presenter can come here. Whoever is going to present.
I'm very glad you're doing this, because now people will miss me. You are far worse than me on managing time. Thank you. My reputation has been restored.
Chairperson, Mina, I'm generous. When you are... I don't know. Chairperson say you are draconian. I'm very generous. Ruthless. It's not me, it's him. You ruffle feathers when it comes to that. So I'm very general.
Restored only in comparison.
And Ryder wants to come into the competition. You are welcome, Honorable Ryder. And for the fact that you are wearing that T-shirt, you can lead us in this competition and outshine Honorable Karim. PBO, over to you.
Sorry, Chairperson, good morning. How many time do you have? How long time do you have?
Please do not exceed 10 minutes. Maybe it's because I told you how much they have consumed. 15 minutes maximum. Please. Continuation of what you have started last week. Linda and the colleagues from media houses, I haven't welcomed you. You're welcome. It's because she was not here. I couldn't see you here. You're also welcome. How much time do you need, Dr. Janji?
We shouldn't go beyond 30 minutes, Chair.
30?
Beyond. We shouldn't go beyond 30 minutes.
Honorable Karim, I want to give you a hand. No. 20 is enough. I'm timing you now. Please.
Okay, thank you, Chief. We'll start. Thank you, Chair, and morning, members. We will start. We will continue from where we ended last week. Our presentation is mainly based on 6 points. We start with the alignment of the budget with the strategic direction of government, mainly on the second priority presented by the President. And then we will look at the changes to consolidated budget in the NCPPS, and that will be followed by the... Yes, fine. That will be followed by a slide on how the economy section, in the economy section, how the changes in the economy also change the revised fiscal framework, and how we can use the fiscal framework and fiscal policy to assist economic growth. We will also look at the growth outlook. We will look at expenditure discussion, and also how the economy influenced that, and we will then end the presentation with a summary of the adjustments budget. So just in terms, I will start and then my colleagues will follow. The strategic direction of the medium-term budget policy statement normally is... in 2017, we went back to 2017, and in terms of the Treasury guidelines, they always indicate to departments, and they request departments to base their budgets on the National Development Plan, the MTSF, and also on the mandate paper. So we went back to the 2017 MTBBS, and we noted that MTBBS was based on the NDP, the Medium-Term Strategic Framework, and the mandate paper. And at that stage, the aim of the mandate paper was to strengthen the alignment of the national budget and the national development plan. So in the 2018 MTBBS, there was actually no mention of the mandate paper. The 2018 MTBBS was then based on the President's Economic Stimulus and Recovery Plan, which you have received the progress on some of the items that was in that plan. So now what happened in 2019? We looked and basically there's still no mention of a mandate paper. And the next medium-term strategic framework, the second phase of the implementation of the National Development Plan, hasn't been published yet. So we are still waiting for the new medium-term strategic framework, and we're wondering what happened to the mandate paper. So the only thing that remains is the seven priorities that the President indicated to us, and that is what the 2019 MTBBS is based on. So just in terms of the alignment of the budget to the priorities, you know that the consolidated budget is categorized within seven function groups, budget function groups. That means that all departments, provincial departments, and just in certain cases, programs within departments are categorized within these budget function groups. And then we looked at the MTBBS, how the departments in these function groups have prioritized or reprioritized their budgets so that they can adhere to the priorities indicated by the President. So in terms of economic development, one of the priorities are to improve agricultural exports, and they also want to strengthen the industrial parks revitalization program, and the Department of Public Enterprises are looking into developing an operational model to improve the support to small and medium enterprises. In terms of the learning and culture functional group, which supports education and skills and health, they really want to improve the efficiency of the lower grades, the reading and mathematics efficiencies. They also want to develop a student funding framework that will include separate subsidies for food and books and accommodation. And then in terms of health, also, they reprioritize funding to improve the efficiency of the health services, and they're also rolling out the health patient registration system. And there's a lot being talking about that. It's also a priority in the NDP, and we can see there are definitely progress in terms of the development of the new system. And they're also reprioritizing funds to establish the National Health Insurance Office, and you've also heard and seen in the MTBBS that we really don't have at this stage the funds that are required to implement the entire NHI, but they will establish the NHI office. In terms of social development, the ECD grants, that was a separate grant, will now be integrated into the equitable share of provincial governments. That is to subsidize the ECDs. In terms of community development, there's definitely going to be additional funding to increase fee basic services to local governments. Transfers to passenger rail of South Africa to improve the stock, and implementing the integrated criminal justice system in the peace and security function group. And there is proposals in the MTBBS that we improve funding to SARS, the AG, and to Stats SA for specific purposes. So with this slide, we're just trying to show you the changes that has been made in terms of the budget per function group. So the changes between the red and the green columns are the changes that has been made in the current financial year. But we've also indicated the increase over the medium term. So in education and health, there was no changes in the current financial year. So there was virements and shifts within the department, but it didn't make impact on the total budget of these departments. The biggest change you will see in terms of social development. Social development, the current year changed from 278 to 277. It doesn't look big, but every year in social development, we've seen the unspent funds. So then they give money back to the fiscus during the adjusted budget process. And the other big increases you will see in the second last function group in terms of the financial transactions in assets and liabilities. That is mainly the funds, the additional funds that has now been allocated to Eskom. And then obviously one of our big expenditure pressures are within the debt service cost. That's the last group of columns. We'll see the change in the current financial year, the red to the green, and also the steep increase over the medium term to 299 billion. Thank you. I'm done with my section, and then we can continue with the economic section.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Siraj Mohammed. We're carrying on to look at the macroeconomic overview and fiscal policy, and we're not going to repeat what we did in our pre-MTPPS talk about how poorly the and expectations are for the local or the domestic economy and global economy. We're going straight into an analysis of the MTPPS, and within that, there's a lot of reference to the National Treasury's policy documents, so we're also dealing with that in our presentation. And within that, a lot of the solutions they offer are at the microeconomic level, what we refer to as sectoral interventions. Now, the first point that I think is important to make is that within the MTBPS and the NT's document, they talk about the role of macroeconomic policy, and they talk about how it creates conditions that could be positive for the economy going forward. But what we're saying is that the MTBPS offers little in terms of macroeconomic analysis and solutions to current economic, to the current economic downturn. Instead, the MTBPS points to solutions outside of the fiscal sphere that may not improve macroeconomic performance during the medium-term expenditure framework. The government seems to overlook its potential role in driving economic growth in the economy through the budget. The solution globally is to use both monetary and fiscal policy, while in South Africa we've hardly used either of these macroeconomic solutions. And we, in our pre-MTPPS presentation, we spoke about quantitative easing and other stimulus in terms of monetary policy, but also a huge push globally towards using fiscal policy to deal with the current downturn, and also during the period after the global financial crisis. Can you change? Okay. Then, having said that, looking at the sectoral interventions proposed and referred to within the MTPPS and proposed in the NT's policy document, we're saying that even successful implementation of programs with ambitious sectoral goals should have a small impact on investment, employment, economic growth, revenue collection, and therefore the debt ratio over the medium-term expenditure framework. Also, successfully achieving these sectoral interventions will be hard, and our experience with the NDP provides an indication of that. The President said in the June 2019 SONA that insufficient progress has been made on the NDP goals in the last medium-term strategic framework. And also, our own research at the PBO show that problems of integration, alignment, coordination, and monitoring and evaluation of NDP activities within the government have been a problem. So many of those issues at the sectoral level within the Treasury document, like dealing with network indices, regulation, competition, and competitiveness, are equally difficult and complex. Furthermore, when you have a demand-constrained, poor global economic growth, we have poor growth in the South African economy, and further, that will further be hampered by fiscal consolidation. It reduces the chances of success of those sectoral interventions. So when the economy is doing well and you try and fix things, it's easier to fix things. When the economy is not doing well and you're also taking money away from the economic cluster, which is something that's been happening over the last medium-term period, we actually expect success to be harder. And further, if they are successful in a poor growth economy, there are going to be constraints on the potential impact of those sectoral interventions. Now, in terms of further constraints to achieving the Treasury's sectoral goals. From a business perspective, we feel that the Treasury's document doesn't take adequately into account what globalization and what we refer to the term that the UN agencies use, hyper-globalization, the impact that has had on the ability to improve things within domestic economies. Now, we're saying international integration and corporate restructuring may constrain achievement of the sectoral goals. The South African economy is a very concentrated economy dominated by large corporations. We are, if you look at Competition Commission documents and papers and findings, we are concentrated at the vertical level and horizontal level. Because of time constraints, I won't go into that now. If there are questions, members can ask that, but most of our markets are dominated by two or three very large firms. These firms have a history of using predatory behavior to limit competition. Also, they have been restructured and internationalized. And with that, they've now basically have to show shareholders in global markets, the shareholder value movement, that they're meeting their maximizing shareholder value goals. And within this, they treat their South African subsidiaries just as assets in large international portfolios. So we're finding that within the outside influence of financial institutions on the allocation of finance within South Africa, but also this is happening globally, there's a prioritization of short-term high returns, not long-term productive fixed investment. So the problem lies not only within government and the inefficiencies in government delivery, but also in the way that big business has become in South Africa, the profits they make here, the way they concentrate our markets, but also how they now play in global markets and treat their South African subsidiaries. Integrated financial markets exposes South Africa to contagion and systemic risks and increases the problems of macro instability. And I think this is really important because the medium-term budget policy statement and the NT document basically say and see macro stability as linked to low inflation, being able to get foreign inflows into South Africa and also keeping confidence in market high by keeping the deficit low as stability. But what we're seeing is that in this world of global financial craziness, that contagion is a huge problem. Okay, I'm going to finish with in 2 minutes, my part. Now, in terms of society, we also see that extreme levels of inequality is a problem. Yeah, we changed that. And this inequality manifests itself along racial categories and reinforces the dysfunction of apartheid spatial outcomes. And basically, I won't go through all these points, but say that this continued distrust related to extreme inequality in South Africa poses real problems for achieving a consensus on how to move forward on things like competition and industrial policy, regulating network industries, especially things like labor market regulation, etc., and privatization and PPPs, for instance, that has come up with the ISCON discussion. So the question that we also then raise is, where will growth come from? And we talk about the public sector and households and investment. Government does not have direct influence over private spending by households and investments by enterprises. Through the budget, government can make choices about government's direct contribution to GDP. With increased expenditure, government can spur more private sector consumption and investment and set off positive multipliers in the economy. The outlook for contribution to GDP from the private sector in the forms of household consumption and private investment means that additional public consumption and investment will be needed to lift GDP in the medium term. We make the point that the public sector contribution to GDP was 26.7%. This includes investment by government and public sector corporations. And the private sector's contribution was 60% from households and 12.5% in terms of investment by private enterprises, which was 72.5%. Now, household consumption and private investment is not expected to increase significantly over the medium-term expenditure framework. An increase in government consumption and investment should add extra percentage points to GDP and support multiplier effects. I think I've mentioned the problems in the pre-MTBPS and now with household consumption increasing and the expectations of poor investment performance. So I won't go into this slide. I'll pass on to my colleague, Rashad, to take us through the revised growth fiscal framework and data.
Thank you. Honourable members, in the few...
Mind you, before, I'm not trying to be rude, we have consumed 17 meters already.
Okay.
Just consider that. Are we all comfortable with the aircon?
No.
It's too cold. Can somebody do something? Thank you. Continue.
Honourable members, as you may have seen a slide similar to this last week, what we present over here is the revised growth outlook over the medium term presented last week compared to what PBO and market is expected. As you're aware, that economic growth is critical for the health of public finances and the ability of the state to provide socio-economic goods and improve living standards of all citizens. What we've seen is a significant downward revision between what was presented in Feb this year and what was presented last week by the Minister of Finance. But real GDP growth isn't the only important part. What's given insufficient attention is nominal GDP growth. Why this is important is because all of your fiscal indicators like debt to GDP, like revenue growth, all matter on nominal GDP growth. What you've seen is as a combination of both poor economic, real economic growth and also low GDP inflation, we're seeing a significant downward revision to nominal GDP and nominal GDP growth expected over the medium term. This has already, we've seen there's a direct impact on that in terms of prices, lower prices across the economy, resulting or contributing to revenue shortfall, certainly on PIT and VAT and CIT. So this is something to consider for the future. Whilst lower inflation isn't necessarily a bad thing for the economy, we've benefited in the past from having inflation closer to 6%. Now with inflation close to the midpoint of the SARB's target range, we've seen the direct effect of low sustained inflation affecting public finances adversely. What this slide presents is a comparison between the budget reviews and Feb this year from the National Treasury, PBO's estimates earlier last month, and was presented last week on key public finance indicators for the main budget for 2019-20. The most stark finding over here is in line with PBO's downward revision. Government downwardly revised its gross tax revenue estimates for the current year, and we're seeing significant shortfalls. The other significant emphasis is the additional allocation for ESCOM, and we're seeing significant worsening of main budget balances as a share of GDP over the medium term. Next slide. The important part to note over here in this main budget framework over the medium term is the additional allocation for ESCOM. So whilst we've seen a downward revision to expenditure over the medium term, you've seen an overall increase in expenditure because of the allocation for ESCOM. In addition to that, and as we mentioned in the previous slide, revenue is expected to grow more slowly than presented in the medium term, resulting in the worsening of fiscal metrics over the medium term, specifically the main budget balance, contributing to higher debt over the medium term. What's important to note over here is, in contrast what is presented in previous MTBPSs and budgets, is the inability of government to realize a primary surplus in the outer year of the MTEF, which is critical for government's realization of debt stabilizing as a share of GDP. We've noted significant shortfalls in revenue. Both the PBO and government estimate significant shortfalls of over 40 billion for this year, and this is a perennial issue we're experiencing. Every year come MTBPS, there's downward revisions to what is presented in the budget, and you're seeing progressively higher revenue shortfalls. So this begs two questions. One with respect to the accuracy of government's estimations, that PBO has done work on this. Secondly, and we welcome the changes at SARS, but is it also a function of SARS inefficiencies? And I think these are important considerations, especially for the finance committees that have direct oversight over SARS. And to ask questions, when there are additional revenue measures being proposed, what are the direct impact of those measures on overall economic growth, on inequality? Are we maintaining the progressivity of the tax system? And what else can be done to broaden the tax base and increase revenue, so to have higher buoyancies, but at the same time not harm lower-income folks, the people on the lower LSMs. So I think these are some considerations. Because of time constraints, we'll have to pass on that.
The net effect of what we've mentioned in the previous slides is the worsening of the medium-term fiscal outlook. We're seeing further slippage. PBO presented what's the green line over here last week, but it's a lot worse than what we presented in part, not because of the differences in nominal GDP growth, but more because of additional expenditure allocation over the medium term, despite the commitments or the guideline that was sent out this year to departments to try and reduce expenditure by compared to February baselines over the second and third year of the MTEP. So we're still seeing increasing main budget balance deficits over the medium term. And the net effect of this is a much higher debt to GDP outlook over the medium term, significantly higher than what was presented in Feb in the red bars, still higher than what was presented by PBO last week. Again, this is very much an ESCOM story. Thank you very much.
Chair, I see the time is up, so I'll just try to wrap up. We've got a couple of slides. I'll try to summarize them within 2 minutes, if you allow me. I think on expenditure, we've got two items we want to talk to. I'll just keep this one. The compensation of employees and the infrastructure expenditure there. I think what we've seen over the years, the conversation about the wage bill has been coming up, but I think it's not clear how it's been brought up has really provided a strategic direction in terms of how it should be dealt with in so far as it affects the public finances. So I think, you know, probably government, you know, sort of wanting direction from the legislature, so how should they deal with the matter. But I think what we try to do here is try to break it down in terms of understanding, substantive understanding some of the issues there. So the slides largely just try to show how much of the 2019 cost of employees was in terms of consolidated expenditure, and how much of that was national, and how much was provincial. But I think what we're trying to provide in the middle is show when has how has the salary cost of COE has increased quite rapidly between 2006 and 2019. But I think when you look at closely to 2010 and 2011, that's where a bulk of it increased, largely because of the government policy in this regard, where there was specific, occupational specific dispensation, where high skilled professionals, medical doctors, teachers, and lawyers were brought into the fore. So I think that's one thing I want to emphasize as well. But I think in part the proportion of it's higher. I mean, cost of employees in public sector is higher compared to the in part because of the most of the public sector employees have higher qualifications, and also you've got a very concentrated percentage of higher middle and senior managers with higher pays, but largely distributive, but accounts for a certain small amount of the expenditure thereof. But I think this slide largely is what how I opened the discussion. So look, there has to be more strategic approach to it, as the chair of the FFC has mentioned, and I think in our emphasis as well. So look, you got to have a strategic overview in terms of what kind of service you want to have and what is the implication of service delivery. But also the other point that we bring in there as well is the implications for other parts of the public finances when you thinking about reducing the state's compensation of employees thereof. The last two graphs there just to emphasize a point raised by colleagues from FFC that we just want to give you a bit of overview in terms of how has the allocations on payments of capital assets over the years, how has it been moving, and there's a sense that it's been largely moving down, whereby the budget it gets appropriated, and later in the year it gets reduced, make way in part for consolidation thereof. But I think why we want to raise this issue of infrastructure expenditure, related to infrastructure expenditure, as a point that was raised by colleagues from the FFC, that when you remember 2018 government fiscal stimulus was largely to use the infrastructure expenditure as a lever to boost economic development, economic growth, but also to look at to ensure that the service delivery is maintained, it doesn't get affected, and look at the maintenance of infrastructure, local government, and so on. But I think the decline in allocation somehow contradicts that approach that was announced in the brief. I think that's what this in these slides we're trying to say. So we've also highlighted some of the points there, which, because another point is that you have underspending or slow spending structure, and clearly, hence sometimes you see, you know, downward decline or reallocation, depreciation from that amount. And I think the point of these two slides is just to say, as part of a site on infrastructure expenditure, you know, consideration is to be given that, you know, what are some of the challenges that the governments, you know, are facing, and there has been work done to try to identify some of the problems. And I mean, our view is that these are the points that are important that needs to be taken into account in terms of how do we ensure efficiency in the supply chain, in the value chain of infrastructure delivery, and how to also make sure that the service delivery model of the infrastructure is backed by more relevant capacity, but also there are specific measures to improve on some of the poor spending and lack of spending in this regard. And lastly, Chair, I mean, both from the national and provincial government, but also the local government as well, there are similar challenges where the planning largely is problematic. You know, I'm not going to go into details, I'm just going to summarize it. There are issues around planning, and once your planning for infrastructure spending is not up to scratch, it affects the entire value chain of spending infrastructure. And I think what we're trying to emphasize is, you know, we can sit and say there's low allocations on infrastructure, but if we don't also take into account some of the challenges, you know, we have the same issues appearing. But I think the most important thing is the impact that would have on economic growth, but also on service delivery at both local government and also in other regions as well, additional government. That's, in a sense, what we want out to conclude. Lastly, last conclusion slide, which emphasizes what we're saying, that the 2019 MTSF, the next MTSF has not been published yet. That is why the MTPS is largely based on the SONA of June SONA. But I think what we also emphasize is that how much government has taken into account its role in trying to deal with some of the issues with the economy, and it's not quite coming quite clearly strongly in the MTPS as it is. Take into account challenges that are faced by society and business, and we emphasize that the government could play a more strategic role in using the public finances to try to boost economic growth and deal with some of the socio-economic challenges that are faced by economy. More so, take into account that there's been downward revision in revenue as expected over the MTF, and also some of the challenges faced by state-owned entities, which and also looking at that, the estimation shows that the debt will continue to grow if the economy is growing as is expected. And yeah, I think that's in a sense what I want to conclude. Thanks so much. I do apologize for taking too much time. Thanks.
You got what you wished for, and I think I allowed that because of the seriousness of the matter on the table. I initially said I'm going to give you 20 minutes. I said 20 minutes is expired. I gave you 5 minutes, it's expired. I gave you another 5 minutes, it's expired. So all in all, you have spent, you've consumed 30 minutes. And members with that understanding, I think you have been empowered. You have had information that we need. Can now allow the members to seek clarities and entertain or get into discussion on the presentation. Maybe let's make it logical. We start by FSC, or you have to indicate which institution you want to respond. So whoever wants to speak, I will give you numbers, and then you'll say this number is, I mean, this question is directed to FFC, or this one is directed to PBO. I'll start with number one, honorable member here, honorable Ryder, number two, Charlie, I mean number three, number four, number five, number six, honorable member, seven, eight, honorable Karim.
No, quite a few, really. I don't want to put my hand up and speak.
So you were... Stop me. What were you doing? I thought you were raising your hand.
No, I wasn't raising my hand. If I have anything to say, needless to say, no one has ever stopped me in the last 16 years.
Oh, you were communicating with Nokolo. I saw what you were doing. Okay. Okay, honorable members, in that order, please.
Thank you for the presentations. Firstly, to the FFC, I'm intrigued by your proposal for the consideration of a fiscal rule and generally supportive of that idea. I wonder whether you could just talk in some more detail about what you have in mind and whether you've done any work on it and whether you'd consider doing work and publishing a paper on that in particular. I am surprised by your policy prescription around free higher education. You will know, I am sure, that there is a wealth of research. The huge majority of public policy research indicates that the opportunity gap in South Africa is actually at the early childhood development phase, and that if you wanted to help give young children a better start to the educational life, that is where you should be spending more money, not at the higher education level. Then a question on growth projections. Both of your presentations have mentioned how wrong Treasury's growth projections have been over so many years. And it strikes me that actually Parliament should do something about that. If Treasury has consistently shown that it's incapable of accurately forecasting growth and that its budget calculations are therefore incorrect, then have you considered, or what would your response be to a proposal that actually you, the FFC, conduct the growth forecasts and that Treasury be obliged to use your forecasts rather than their own? Then I'd ask your view on classifying Eskom support as debt, as announced by the Minister in the speech. I said last week that from my perspective, that's just nonsense. It's creative accounting, and I'd like your view on that, please. Then over to the PBO. I must say I was very surprised by the suggestion, sir, that that additional fiscal stimulus is required. I don't see how that's possible in South Africa right now with a 6.5% budget deficit and debt approaching 70% of GDP. How any further fiscal stimulus is possible. I saw in a later slide you referred specifically to infrastructure spending. Now, of course, I would entirely agree that much more infrastructure spending is necessary. But the point is that infrastructure spending is being crowded out by consumption spending. So there's no space to grow infrastructure spending by borrowing more. And I hope that's not what you were suggesting. So I would just ask for your clarity on that. I would ask the same question to you about growth projections at the Treasury as to whether Treasury should perhaps be obliged to use your growth projections rather than their own because they seem unable to get them right. And then if I could just ask you to be slightly more direct. When you say that we've got this huge number of millionaire managers in the civil service and you say that their salaries are largely distributed, that reads very much like a euphemism to me. What exactly do you mean by largely distributive? Does that mean that there's very little value for money in their salaries? And I'll just challenge one other thing you say. You say that the salaries of those millionaire managers account for a very small portion of the budget. Actually, they do not. They are a huge portion of the cost of employment to the state. We have made a proposal for how just by addressing that echelon of managers' salaries, you could shave 150 billion rand off the wage bill over 3 years. That's no small money. So I don't think that we should write it off as a small portion of the budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Leader.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And again, appreciation for the two presentations. Before I go into the detail of it, Chairperson, perhaps I also want to just address the fact that the FFC made the point of the constitutional mandate that they carry, and the fact that they have presented such a comprehensive document today to such a large group of members who all want to engage with it and get into the meat of this. I think that the time that we've had and to rush through these presentations is perhaps not doing them justice and not doing our constitution and our oversight role justice. So I think that perhaps programming could be a little bit better managed in future, that we can separate PBO and FFC, you know, that each is given a fair amount of time and we can probe these things quite carefully. I'm going to start with the FFC questions, if I may. I think that the first one I have relates to slide number 4, where it was mentioned that there's fiscal leakages. I'm intrigued that you've highlighted this, and I'd like to probe it a little bit more. Are we talking about exchange control leakages, or are we talking about other leakages? And if you can perhaps give us just a little bit more insight into what you were pointing there and why particularly it was flagged, because I thought that was quite important. Moving on to page slide 13, the fiscal reprioritization consolidation. I think that this has perhaps been understated in both presentations, and the fact that reprioritization has had to happen often at the expense of social delivery and reprioritizing towards things like making up for state capture, dealing with the debt trap. There was a comment there that indicated, I think, that something that I'm strongly in agreement with, and this is the refocusing of the developmental state role to rather refocus the developmental state to focusing on social imperatives rather than employing people and getting them onto the government wage bill. So I just wanted to highlight that point. Slide 15. Again, I felt that there was a trick missed on this particular slide about policy uncertainty, and the fact that there's generally a sentiment of an aversion to risk taking on in light of the policy uncertainty, and it was just something I wanted to add onto that slide. Then we get on to the slide 19, where we talk about the Commission endorses the implementation of measures to contain the wage bill. And they talk about freezing salaries. Now, freezing salaries is great as a concept in terms of the total amount. But freezing salaries across the board, I think, is going to lead to a skills leakage, is going to be counterproductive, and actually is going to end up punishing the people that you are tasking with getting us out of the hole that we're in. And it's not dealing with the guys that, you know, you might be dealing with the guys that historically have gained. But by freezing salaries across the board on an individual basis, I think that is highly counterproductive. I'm pleased to see lots of nods across the room there. You know, that would work in a vacuum, but it's not going to work in this. Slide 20, I just felt that the straight line projections of expenditure is incredibly simplistic. And when you look at the cost structures, for example, of tertiary education, which would have a large expenditure at the beginning of the year and a slow expenditure at the end of the year. Again, with the PFMA and the way it's set up, you do expect slower expenditure in the beginning of the financial year and a peak at the end. I think that is the same. It's replicated across the world, across governments. So, it's simplistic to expect that after 6 months you're going to be at 50% expenditure. Was just a criticism I had there. I think it's massively important, and again understated on slide 22, where you talk about the issues around the district municipality system and the fact that so many of them are dysfunctional, they are understaffed, they don't have the capacity, they don't have the skills in there at the moment, and yet we're about to spend money or we're about to thrust a whole lot of responsibilities onto them. It's going to take massive funding and that policy change is going to need serious funding over the next couple of years. I think conclusion and recommendations, particularly page 34, again, you spoke there about the protection of social expenditures, which speaks again about the refocusing of money out of social expenditure into debt. The Commission implores government to carry through the initiatives to restore the economy, growth and create employment. These need to improve on policy credibility and implementation. I think that goes again to policy certainty that I was mentioning just now. And the cogent review of the public sector wage bill buying into that 100%. Thank you very much to the FFC for the work on that. Much appreciated. Moving to the PBO, I found there was too much focus on the data and not enough on the policy and the sentiment behind it on this. I'm going to just highlight three issues. So slide 12, and again, I think this points to the issue that the forced reprioritization of the budget has taken money from where we need to spend it, from where we need to be spending it. And if you look at the small business department, they've had $300 million taken away from them in this budget. And yet we're pointing out on slide 12 on bullet point 2 that the SA economy is concentrated and dominated by large corporations. So instead of trying to boost SMEs, we're actually taking money away from there, which I found problematic. The higher debt outlook on slide 24, I think that was just something that, it's depressing. And I wanted to point out, slide 31, unfortunately we had to rush through it, but the key issues for oversight on infrastructure expenditure, I think this is where a lot of fiscal leakage is happening at an expenditure point of view, and I think this is a massively important slide and something that needed to be highlighted a little bit more strongly, especially when one considers the DORA aspect and the fact that a lot of the amounts are transferred through to provinces, and then we lose our control and our oversight role on that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Rider. Charlie?
Ngiyathoko was a slide. No, we welcome both presentations from the FFC and PBO. Just one question on FFC, and I think, and then two comments after. My question is, to what extent have your recommendations been taken into consideration by both the Treasury and Parliament previously? That's my question, because I think you are making a lot of sense, I think, in most of the things that we're saying. So I'm just checking as to what extent have those recommendations previously been taken into consideration. Now, to make a comment on I think on slide 14 and slide 19, I think here you are saying that the Commission notes that year after year, actual rates of economic growth and revenue collection have consistently failed to reach its projected target. And on the second bullet there, you are saying, more specifically, notwithstanding the direct cost of adding to fiscal deficits as a result of overestimating tax revenue. Just to end it there, I think I fully agree with this point, because to me it looked like, I think we have seen, I think in the past few years, that our economy has not been growing as expected. And as a result, we have not been able to create enough new jobs. And as a result, we have not been able to deal with the issue of inequality and also the issue of poverty. However, it looks like when we do the budget, but we become too ambitious to say we're going to have this kind of revenue. Whereas we have seen perhaps in 2 or 3 years back that our economy has not been growing. So I think it's something that we need to look at very seriously. As much as we are coming up with initiatives to grow the economy, but let us not be too ambitious in projecting the revenue, because I think that's where we get problems. Because when we are unable to collect that revenue, then it affects the entire budget. So I think it's a point that I think we have canvassed. I think very seriously, and that which I think we need to look at. But the second point is the issue which I think you spoke about on slide 19, where you are saying an option of tax hike. I mean, tax hikes is not an option in terms of increasing the revenue, because the challenge is that you've got people who are paying taxes, who are giving Kesari what is due to Kesari, as the minister is saying. However, we also have a challenge of people who are not paying taxes. But now, if you consistently increase taxes, people who are suffering are those who are paying. You see, I think in my view, we need to do more in terms of making sure that those who are not paying, they pay, instead of penalizing those who are paying. Because the more you increase the taxes, it means you are penalizing those who are paying, because they've got to pay more because others are not paying. Using Ndebele Valley City, so if you've got two donkeys that are pulling a cart, the one that is pulling hard is the one that gets whipped more harder for it to pull more harder. So let us not, the more we increase the taxes, those who are paying us, they pay more, whereas those who don't pay, they don't pay. So let's focus on, say, those who are not paying. Let's have more strategies. Let law enforcement agencies play their role in making sure that they also pay, while we also deal with the issue of economic growth. I see here that the same on the same slide, that our projections of revenue shortfalls for 2019-20 is at about 52.5 billion rands, and that's a lot of money. And it says for the following year, I mean for 2021, it will be at 84 billion rands. I think that's a lot of money. It shows that there's something wrong with our projection. As much as we've got a challenge of economic growth, but it means our projection were also too ambitious. So I think it's an issue that we need to look at. The last point is on the issue of local government. I think as much as we've got these challenges that we're facing of economic growth and stuff like that, but the issue of decreasing the allocation to local government, we need to also look at it very thoroughly. Maybe have a way of not using a blanket approach, especially looking at rural municipalities, because we've got these rural municipalities who are not generating any revenue on their own. They are dependent on national allocations and also on grants. So I think as we are decreasing the allocation to local government, but let's make sure that rural municipality, we don't do that to rural municipality. We can perhaps do that to metros and other urban municipalities. But with regard to rural municipality, I think it's going to have a very negative effect, especially on service delivery, because those municipalities are solely dependent on national allocations. Thanks, Sarangatos.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, my first question really is very broad, I think, and I would love to have some view from both FFC and PBO. First and foremost, I want to join the other members in really appreciating the empowerment from both presentations. My question, Chair, is on the wage bill, which has been identified in both presentations as a problem. Now, has there been some kind of broad research on how best we can go about with this without creating the necessary tension? And I wanted to check whether the wage bill issue cannot be researched vis-a-vis the unemployment rate in our country. And I'm raising it as well in view of the fact that we have this large wage bill and yet we have a lot of unfunded vacancies in departments. So if you can get some views on that. Mr. Cheng, you have raised an issue with, of course, our muted economic growth, and you talked to issues of inefficiencies. If I can raise clarity there, whether when you talk fiscal reprioritization, consolidation, and credibility, if you could point out very clearly to us for the nation as to what our inefficiencies are, because we're looking there that you do have some proposals in terms of what needs to be done, which is good. Lastly, Chair, I also want to speak on the issue of municipalities. And I note that Dr. Faku raises issues on the current weaknesses in district municipalities. Again, here I would like to hear the view or what research has been done by PBO, for example, although this has been raised by FFC, but FFC talks to the current weaknesses in district municipalities and then the decline on the budget. And I want to join my colleague and comrade Kichima when he speaks to the issue of not using a blanket approach for the municipality, because it is true that you cannot keep throwing money when it there's no capacity to use it. But my question to PBO is whether there hasn't been a plan in the past to get rid of some of the provincial institutions, looking, for example, at joining district municipalities with legislatures, whether that study has been done and what are the possibilities of such studies. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Zembo.
Thanks, Chairperson.
I'm not sure that if Long Bushela Pekalen Kwam, Akamananga, Kopana, and don't just bali there. Now, I'm tempted to start with my last question because she posed it, but more or less the way I would.
Chair, this goes to both.
FFC and PTO. Is there no way of managing the wage bill without actually tampering with labor relations? Because we have to manage labor relations whilst at the same time we have got this elephant in the room.
The second one, Chair, also going to both. You shied away from talking to this, both of you. What is the impact of the president restructuring to the executive, particularly cabinet? I need both your perception and fact, because many of us are saying there would be some financial impact on the restructuring. Having read the medium-term budget policies statement, is there an impact? Chair, I'm deliberate in saying I want both their perception and fact.
That goes also, Chair, with the impact of the statement into the realization of the President's injunctions in SONA. Do we see realization of SONA in this statement? Chair, this goes to FFC. Reading your comments in slide 17 and understanding that this was, as I just said, a medium-term budget policy statement. It's not a budget. Can you, as we go towards the February budget day, without saying this should have been, as you project there in slide 17, but you develop your own guide, your own slide, which is both a content in terms of word and figures, guiding us perhaps as we engage Treasury before the actual approval of the budget, Chair. The last one goes to both, though it's raised by FFC, slide 29. There, you mentioning two, I don't want to say culprits, but I want, let me choose a better word, Chair, by saying the state-owned company is not doing very well. Eskom and SIA. What would it be if perhaps we talk instituting a forensic audit to both those? Because we cannot continue pouring in water in a leaking basket. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Joseph.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentations. I do support my colleague previously have raised the issue about the time that we give to the FFC and the Parliament Budget Office. It's very important structures that support us in our work, and I think they are professional people and we must give them more time. My question on FFC, or my point rather, slide 15, is on the township economies, which in my views, some people frame it as an informal economy, and you know, are there any information from SARS what that economy is, and from the municipalities what that economy includes? Otherwise, I'm asking if there's any research about the township economy itself. What does it mean to SARS? How much money are we losing? The minister himself said the other day he went to buy a charger and he paid for it and he asked for a receipt in a mall, quite a big place, and there was no receipt. There's no receipt available, which is a sign of people are collecting money but not paying over to SARS what is due to SARS. And I'm sure in municipalities across the country is happening. Slide 18, the salaries. My point is, should we not start making projections about how much money we can save? Because everyone is talking about the wage bill and no one is willing to say what we must do with the wage bill. So maybe we must start doing projections on cutting the salaries of all public reps, all three spheres, and all the senior management of public service and state-owned entities. We must start making that projections. What is it, the 2% cut instead of 6% inflation, 4% inflation, 2% under inflation? Those projections we must start to make to see how much money we ourselves can contribute to the financial crisis we are in. And then the slide 20 on the higher education. I expect slide 20, underspending on higher education, and the next point on rural development. I do expect higher education to have a better, higher percentage spending. It's learned people. Fill in a form, they apply for accommodation or transport or administrative support, straightforward, unless there's no accommodation. But if I compare that spending to building of houses, rural development, which have a history of its own, in terms of land and court cases and disputes, where you can't actually determine the pace up front. You have a plan, but the rollout is not the same, with all the obstacles that come in between. So I understand why that is lower, and of course the people must be educated as well in terms of that laws and what it means to them to make that transformation. So I do expect higher spending in higher education. To the Parliament Budget Office, my view is on the growth, the slide on growth on the public sector. Now, I'm saying that it should be both. The government must stimulate growth in the public sector, and one of the areas they can do it is approving of building plans. If we can have all municipalities that can approve building plans within the minimum amount of days, It kicks the economy out of the private sector and individual households to go and stimulate the economy. The same with humane settlements in building of this house. It does stimulate the economy, and then government's own infrastructure, providing water and electricity, stimulates the economy. If those things are planned for 30, 40 years from now, besides that plans, short term, medium, if it's there, it stimulates the economy. So, but thank you for the sharing of the information. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Kaiso.
I'm pressing the wrong thing. Thank you very much, Chairperson. welcome the presentation made by both the FFC and PBO. I want to go straight to FFC to seek this clarity or this understanding that you talked about the underspending in terms of NHI grant by the Department of Health, and also to say, given the macroeconomic outlook estimate which were given during the release of the both the white paper and the green paper in 2007 and 2011 respectively, it had given a certain budget to roll out NHI, but according to what you put in front of us now, it does seem that it is no longer applicable. So what does that mean now? Because now, in terms of what we are doing in terms of NHI, we said it must be on a high speed. And if you can see, as the matter has been fast-tracked in terms of the bill, so is this a contradictory view that one speaks up? That does it mean that now that we are not going to move step forward in terms of this statement, in terms of NHI? So, because I think it's very much important to understand that, much as we are fast tracking NHI, but now as soon as you say your observation is that the green paper and the white paper's intentions are beginning to reverse that, then it's a serious concern, very, very big one. secondly, I just want to, you know, Friday, somebody went to constituency, somebody asked me, hey, have yet, do you still remember what the president said during the announcement and also in the manifesto that there's going to be 275 jobs that are going to be created? Can you tell me how far are you now? In terms of the budget, I said, wait a bit. So I thought maybe I'm in a relevant platform just to get your view, your understanding. How does that statement integrate into the MTBS medium-term budget statement? Help us there to say how do I locate it here easily? Because it's a very important commitment. And also, the job summit, presidential job summit statement says something, because there's a lot that has been said in terms of, you know, jobs, unemployment. But now when you look at the presidential job summit, where I want to struggle, and can you assist to understand, in as far as you are concerned, where do you locate this here in the medium-term budget expenditure statement? The lastly is the issue on PBO, the labor market regulation and privatization, private partnership. I just want to understand what you mean by that as a constraint. If you can expand that so that I understand, because now I can't ask a question. I just want to say it's one of the constraints. What constraint? The labor regulation. That is where I want to go, but I just want to comprehend it quite nicely. Thank you very much.
Honorable Peter.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want also to join the colleagues in thanking the FFC and the PBO for their presentations. And I think these presentations, Chairpersons, are very helpful for us in
making it possible for us to engage with different role players in the budget processes, including National Treasury and the different departments. Chairperson, I would join Honourable Kaiso with regard to the concern around the underspending in NHI, because I would remember that in the 2017-2018 review, you did reflect both PBO and FFC. You did reflect on the underspending with regard to NHI. And one of the areas was also because in the Department of Health was not employing the requisite competent and experienced and qualified people for being able to make it possible that they can drive this particular process. The bill is now out for public comment and all over. And already you are signaling slow spending again in the NHI component. And I think Chairpersons, both from the select committees of the NCOP and the Standing Committee, Honourable Sfiso Buthelezi, will have to follow up on this particular matter, primarily because it is now an indication that it's consistent. We are driving a policy out there in the public space, and already it shows that internally in government there's no capacity to be able to make sure that the NHI is a success. So I think it is important that the chairpersons also engage with the chairpersons of the portfolio committee, Honourable Gromo and the one of the NCOP with regard to this matter. The other one is related to the underspending in the areas, chairpersons, of I think it's slide 20 of the FFC presentation, where you give an indication that departments like Environmental Affairs, Water Sanitation, Human Settlements show a bit of below average spending. I hear what Honourable Joseph is speaking about with regard to the length of time it takes to process applications for different regulatory required licensing and land use policy related matters. But I'm worried because it would mean that the department did not plan well, because the budget would have been informed by the plans of the department. So it already means that Human Settlement in particular and water and sanitation, we do have communities that are really having challenges with regard to water and sanitation. The quality of water in some instances, the breakdown of the water infrastructure in others, where you'd have communities consistently not having access to water, not necessarily because of the drought situation, but because the infrastructure is just not adequate. So I think it is important that we also look into those particular areas. Department of Water and Sanitation says water is a human right and sanitation is dignity. So if there's slow spending in that area, it means that there are people that we are denying their human rights as well as their dignity. With regard to the area of land reform, rural development and land reform, I also get worried, Chairpersons, because it would then mean that the challenges of slow delivery of either land restitution, land distribution, but also support to emerging farmers. Chairperson, you'd remember that, and members of SCOA, you'd remember that in the previous rounds of public hearings, we had concerns from emerging farmers who were saying, we've been given land without the necessary support to work the land. Now the farms are lying fallow. Maybe they got the farms under production, but because of lack of funding and support from the department, they actually requested SCOA to encourage the Department of Land Reform to give them consistent support and to give them the necessary financial support to make sure that the land can be worked. And it speaks also to issues of food security. So I think it's important that we look into that area. Chairperson, it's very interesting to listen to the PVO, the issues related to the matter of the compensation of state employees. I think sitting here, it's the first time that I've actually heard somebody speak so positively for public servants. And I think maybe they wherever they are seated, they would be saying that person must become the DG of public service because he's protecting us. And when there's consistent talk of reducing the wage bill, but also the reducing the public service, you coming to show us an indication that in fact, you if you touch this, you are shooting yourselves in the foot because these are the people that consistently because. I would say they are a captive audience when it comes to a SARS because they are the taxpayers. So you are saying if you reduce the taxpayers, you are then going to reduce the budget that you need for other services, which for me is actually a better argument for us to consider. Probably Chairperson's in engaging with the portfolio committee of public service and the ministry of public service, you could then be able to use this particular argument because you are questioning. But you are also saying we are having a different workforce that is qualified because they are the ones that has got tertiary qualifications and all those particular things. I think for me, this is a good argument that we could then be able to look at as opposed to just a blanket approach that the Minister of Finance was saying there's multimillionaires out there, forgetting that those multimillionaires, the million has got implications for revenue, services and others. So I think for me, that has been very helpful. But Chairperson, I think in our own discussions at a later stage, the information that has been provided by FFC and the information provided by the PBO is very helpful. Thank you very much.
Welcome. The stage is yours.
Thank you, Chair. I must apologize for being late. I started in the committee, the Portfolio Committee on Constitutional Development and Justice, even though I'm not a lawyer. I tried to follow the fancy English there and with great difficulty. Chair, I think I want to weigh in on the last point made by Honorable Peters because the issue here is very clear. That I think at first what should happen is that we should be able to quantify, conduct proper researches to say if we were to stem the tide of fiscal leakages that are caused by state institutions in particular, how much saving would we be able to make? Because I feel like the discussion on the public sector wage bill, while in many instances is well-intentioned and well-placed, but I think people use it as a low-hanging fruit without considering the implications of reducing the size of the public sector when you have levels of inequality that were cited by Dr. Plachis in his presentation. And that when you have to consider, you can't run away from the fact that we're in two-nation state country. There are levels of inequality, some are very rich, and there's this perception, incorrect perception, that when you work in the private sector, you're incompetent and therefore overpaid, right? Now, we need to address the challenges where we know there were clear cases of cadre deployment where people who don't qualify to be in particular positions still occupy those positions and try to resolve those issues. But I think there's also a competent team, community of leaders in the private sector that can help us to turn around the situation. We shouldn't be too negative. I view the focus from National Treasury as political focus. They are trying to improve economic outlook when they know that growth focus aren't going to be achieved.
I don't even take them seriously. I look at other institutions to get a more accurate figure, a more accurate focus when it comes to growth. Indeed, the proposal which was made earlier to say maybe they shouldn't be the ones, remember they are government, they shouldn't be the ones who are actually doing this exercise and providing a forecast on which investors and different role players in society can rely on. It's a complete waste of time. I cited this issue long before there was even Minister Nene, and Minister Godan then later on defended it, but we're still sitting with the same problem. The the other issue here, Chair, is that I'm not going to pick up and say PBO and all of that. They can all respond to the questions. I mean, we're discussing the same issue. This is the economy. But specifically when it comes to the FFC, they talk about the gross revenue, which is projected to fall fall short of the budget by 52.5 billion and 2019-2020 and 84 billion in 2020-21. The most interesting thing about this thing is that we're always accurate when it comes to this forecast. We're always very close to whatever we forecast and said. If it's 52 billion, it might overshoot with a billion, but when it comes to growth forecast, we never hit the target. That much is clear. I mean, I've already made a political statement by saying that. But I think, Prof, to what extent does this... look, when at first, when we're talking about these shortfalls, revenue shortfalls, they were attributed to the hollowing of the of SARS by state capture, to say there were serious capacity constraints issue at SARS, right? Now you also talk about the growth outlook being very bleak. Now, to what extent can we attribute it to capacity issues? If SARS is busy saying they have their own turnaround strategy, like most SOEs have turnaround strategies that never, in many instances, that are never able to turn these institutions around, to what extent can we then say, after, say, 2021 or 2022, the situation will stabilize because SARS will be at a particular trajectory in terms of the capacity issues and challenges that they face? Because they need to be able to give us confidence to say, yes, one aspect of it has always been about weak economic growth in the country, but another aspect of it had to do with internal issues which they could address and reputational issues which SARS could be able at some point be able to address. I want to talk about an issue, perhaps, Chairperson, you might call me to order for digressing, but it's a skills development issue. And it's a very worrying issue where young people go to these FET colleges. They do this N1, N5, N6, N7, and they drop out of high school, right? Say they do standard 8 and then they go to an FET college. But then they are stuck between being able, between having that N1, N6 qualification and being able to attain their national diplomas. Because this institution make it their responsibility to find themselves on their own in service training. It's ludicrous. You go to a technology, university of technology, it's the responsibility of the institution to a large extent to help you secure placement. Now, if I'm 18, 19, 20 years old, how am I going to be able to find placement for myself? Now, you have a lot of these students who are discouraged, demotivated, because they don't know where to go, and then millions of them are sitting with these qualifications, which, if the government could be able to assist them with placements, even in SOEs, we would address the challenge. And in no time, they'll be able to have their national diplomas. It improves, it contributes to skills development, and it's something that we can do very easily and very quickly. I want to say to Prof. Yankis in particular, parliamentary scrutiny and accountability. We're saying the Commission emphasizes the importance of governance, parliamentary scrutiny, accountability through consequence management in ensuring delivery in a performing state. I couldn't agree more. But I feel to a large extent that this Parliament has not been able to quite adequately do that. Perhaps we need to have a discussion about the consequence management aspect of it when SOEs, government departments, do not adhere or do not take even seriously committee recommendations which are made year in and year out, because we are where we are today because some of these issues were cited and recommended many, many moons ago, but they were ignored by the same SOEs and departments without consequences, with impunity. What is it that we can do differently in order to ensure that there is consequence management? The PBO make a good example here to say that potential constraints to achieving the N and National Treasury sectoral goals They cite a number of issues, including competition and industrial policies, labor market regulation. You may have explained, it's possible that you might have explained these issues when I was not here. I would like you to explain them again to say, what about competition and industrial policies? What about labor market regulation that needs to be done differently? And I know I'm trying to drag you into an ideological debate, but you'll know how to handle it. The other issue here, Prof, is one of the issues we raised as the UDM in our manifestos was that perhaps the time has come for us to have hard and fast rules when it comes to debt management. Not leave it up to the whims of whoever is running the country to say, we need to get to a point where maybe we introduce a debt management bill of some kind, where we have limits. Limits. It doesn't matter who runs the country. You can't take our debt level, for example, to more than 75%. And obviously, once you have a bill or an act of parliament that governs that, it will have to be very balanced. Other countries are doing it, even though they are not very disciplined. They still exceed those targets that they've set themselves. But I think we need to have that discussion at some point and see whether it would not improve the discipline when it comes to management and governance of public finances. Chairperson, thank you for now. Ndiyabulela.
Nami ndiyabulela, ngicela ukuqisha.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Grant.
You now switch on the other one. Okay. Thank you. Honorable members, I thank you for the engagement. And I think it was on purpose that I have not given you, as usual, the 2 minutes for you to ask questions. And I hear members are complaining about the time that has been given to PBO and FFC. And I think we have members received documents before, we've gone through documents, and I thought we will have enough time to members to interrogate the documents, the presentation. But I've been generous also coming to members, not to limit you, so that you go as far as you can to probe the documents and the presentations. And members, I want to join you in welcoming the presentation from both from PBO and FSC. And I will start by tapping into what Honorable Skofana has said. In as far as the recommendation, how far the question he asked, he wanted to know how far does Treasury take in consideration your recommendation. And I just thought of it and said, how far do we take these recommendations as honorable members, as oversight players, because the responsibility of Treasury, I mean of PBO, is to empower us so that we can be able to speak to issues and identify issues. But also it's important to hear the criticism from Treasury if they take their experience. And I tried to check if there's anyone coming from Treasury. There's no one. Oh, how many? Three. Thank you. I tried to check and I was told there's no one, but thank you for being here. And I appreciate that you took your time, you heard the criticism and what direction as members and also as institutions we want you to take. Constructively, we are criticizing what we have received. Somebody spoke about, or is PBO, spoke about the size, because there was this issue of public service, the cutting of or the reduction of the wage bill.
And it's something that does not start today or 10 years back or 15 years back. Having been a public servant myself and an activist in that sector, I know that the slimming, the figure of the public service has been an issue coming from the relevant department or government. And the big question that comes from PBO is that how do you start to speak about the cutting of the wage bill without knowing the size, scientifically so, and knowing what size are you? Have you taken the measurement so that when you cut this cloth, it fits well? But also, the knowledge of the size of the public service will also help you to buy the suitable size of the material that you want to cut for this dress or this jacket, because you won't use the same material to make a jacket that will suit Honorable Skosana and that of Honorable Detoit. So it won't be the same. So you need to know the measurement. Having said that, honorable members, we previously spoke of tracking system. And Honorable Nkwanka is talking about that, and other members. The tracking system. Are we engaging and recommending, criticizing for the sake of doing it? Because we're paid to do so. What happens to the resolutions, the recommendations that we are taking as a committee? But the other question that comes to my mind is that we can make sure that we track how far resolutions are implemented or recommendations are implemented by the relevant institutions or departments coming from the committee. But in as far as the consequence management, what if, what if these things, they don't happen? These resolutions are not happening. How sharp are our teeth? What powers do we have as the oversight body to can make sure that there are consequences in as far as those people that were taking decision to say this must be done by this time and that is not done? I think our powers also need to be measured. How far can we go? It's a very important homework that I'm giving to members. And in all our corners, let's talk about them, because we have taken a commitment that we want to change the complexion of this parliament as sixth parliament. We don't want to be a dog that is just barking and not biting. So the other questions that I have are to FFC. Remember when we had an engagement with you previously in Max Building, when you presented the state of municipalities that are dysfunctional and lack capacity, depressing, one of the depressing session that I'll never forget. Not that I didn't know, but I might have known, but not the to that extent. I did not know that it's that deep. The question that I have following that presentation that you have given to us, I want it to assist us, because this information that we get from you, we utilize this information when it's recorded, it's legal. When we make debates, when we argue, when we make statements, one needs to be more capacitated, if you can help us, FFC, to know what is the source. Have you conducted a study that assisted you to come to that level of assessment, so that we can also tap into that source, utilize it? The next one is that in the previous engagement, when you made a presentation about the special bill on ESCOM, you said government guarantees to ESCOM accounts on average for almost 74% of the total government guarantee to all public institutions to 350 billion rands between 2015-16 and 2019-18. That's what you said during that session when we were dealing with the special appropriation for ESCOM. Today in your presentation, just help me, I'm a bit confused. You're saying guarantees to ESCOM are estimated to account for over a half. I don't know, over half, you're still speaking to the 74%, but you stated 56% of the total government guarantees of the SOEs. According to me, which I'm not a specialist in this area, I find some contradictions. I seek your assistance so that I can understand what makes you to shift from 74% to 56%. What informs that? Because these are recorded figures, are recorded is recorded information, and we use this information. So also, if you indicate how you source your information, it assists us, it empowers us, so that we can also on our own consult those sources. If there's no one else who wants to speak, I will hand over to FFC and PBO. Who's going to start?
FFC. Chair, excuse me.
Who's that?
It's me here. Chair, excuse me.
Okay.
Just a rider on your last question. If these percentages could be reduced into real figures, these 70-something percentages, yes, if they could be reduced to figures, thanks, Chair.
Okay. Are you?
No, Chair, I think you're raising an important point that perhaps we're not discussing at times as Parliament, to say, since we have a lot of institutions that have state-owned enterprises that have government guarantees, has the time not come for this Parliament, working together with these institutions, to develop a government guarantee oversight model that we can use as a template as Parliament? Because we have all these fiscal leakages because of these SOEs. And up until we design a new model, we are not going to be able to effectively and adequately oversee these entities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members and Chairpersons. I've got my colleagues with me that I introduced, and I would ask that a different chairperson that I will cover some of the answers, but on the local government issues, I would ask Dr. Ngobe and Dr. Faku to answer that. On the fiscal leakages, I will ask Sheng to answer that. On the whole question of growth projections, yes, we can do it, but I want to ask the CEO to speak to that matter on it. But let me come to the last point that the chairperson raised, because I think there's a slight misunderstanding. Chairperson, when you, the 56% that you see here in slide 28, it's 56% of all the guarantees. The 74% was the 74 of the major SOEs within the country. That's the only difference there. So it doesn't detract from the 54, or rather the 56%, and it's also not incongruent to the 74%. The one is the major. Just to take the major SOEs, it gives you 74%, and if you take the total SOEs, it will give you 56%. On the fiscal rule, the point that we're making, and it's probably connected to the government guarantee model, the issue is in most democracies you will find that there are constitutional limitations to borrowing, to government guarantees issued and the issuance of that to institutions. The EU, they're struggling with their own rules because there's an issue of compliance to the rules across the different countries. In the States, there's been a number of federal cases with regard to constitutional limits. The question is that what we're saying, there needs to be a standard of measure which is public that helps Parliament to when an appropriation gets to you, when the cash injection request comes to you through a special appropriation, you at least need to know what is the standard of measure here. Firstly, for approaching, secondly, for review and issuance, and thirdly, for approval. And truth be told, these things come to Parliament. And, I mean, we've been sitting in this space. I don't know on what basis sometimes, other than the alarm question that gets raised, that if a cash injection doesn't get given, there might be a threat of across the board a default call up on government loans, which is a real threat. But we need to have a standard of measure that helps to determine publicly for Parliament as to how do you look at government guarantees, how do you look at cash injections, and how do you minimize all the other noise around it, but look at the risk that of these things relative to the national interest and the sovereign. So that's the key question that we're raising here. And yes, it requires consideration. We're raising it because there are, if you look at, and chairpersons and honorable members, the numbers that you see in our slides are not our numbers. It's in the MTBS documents. It's in the adjusted estimates. It's in the amendments to the Division of Revenue. And it's in previous documents. So we're not inventing here. It's the information that's been presented, and we're trying to make it much more clearer to you. On the Eskom debt issue, I didn't get the question from the first honorable member. I don't want to mention names because you mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4. We didn't yet get the question, other than to say yes. Our view, then there needs to be some preconditions set in any case for any debt, and that links to the first point that we've raised around the fiscal rule, but also possibly because this Parliament performs based on legislation, based on regulations, and if these are not clear and tight, you're going to sit here next year again and ask what should be the appropriate levels, and how do you then juxtapose the relationship of dealing with that relative to the ministry, relative to the national treasury, and that. Just a quick thing on fiscal leakages, how does it occur? Fiscal leakages normally occurs when there's inappropriate rules, when there's a weakness in administration to apply the rules appropriately and equally, and equitably across the board, when there's fraud and corruption, when there's irregular practices taking place, and when there's a manipulation of rules. That's how fiscal leakages occurs in the system. And for instance, in the SASSA system, fiscal leakages is like almost like the norm in that particular system. Now, I think what I want to make clear, because the Honourable Member said there are people, he's happy that people shake their heads when we talk about freezing of salaries. I don't know why people shake their heads in the affirmative. All that we did was to paraphrase the Minister of Finance when he said that there will be a freezing of salaries for the executive authorities, i.e. ministers and deputy ministers. That's all that we did. We didn't talk about public servants in that space. But we're also suggesting then, if you do it, look at dealing with it across the system when it comes to executive authorities. That's the only point that we're making. And while you're busy with it, apply to SOEs. That's all. So I don't know. That's just the thing that we need to fix, because sometimes what we say gets misunderstood. So we're quoting the Minister of Finance on it. Then let me just go to another quote of the Minister of the MTPBS. Because this is not what we are saying. This is what the MTPBS medium-term budget policy statement document is saying, that red book that I showed earlier. It says on, and I asked the staff that we need to quote this thing in terms of its page number, so that nobody says that we are saying it. Chairpersons, it says, however, on the implementation of the NHI, however, given the macroeconomic and fiscal outlook, the estimates to roll out the NHI that were published in the NHI Green Paper in 2011 and in the White Paper in 2017 are no longer affordable. We just leave that with you. That is in the document that's going to be said, which you're going to adopt as Parliament. And it clearly shows the level of deep contestation within the system around the NHI. We as the FFC, we have our questions around the NHI, but we support the National Health Insurance scheme. Just for the record, because it also goes out that we're having issues with it. We support the NHI. But we have key questions around the implementation and the rollout of it and the approach to it. On the matter of the wage bill, the public service wage bill, can I please go on the record again? We're not on that train. We are concerned that the wage bill is quite high, but we're not on that train, and the reason why is a policy statement that the president made, that we need a government to reorganize the state. Now, if you reorganize the state, it is the consequential, the logic of that, you need to look at the size and the shape of the state. So you need to look at how the state is structured. You need to look at how the state is resourced. Financial, human capital, infrastructure, the range. And I think we every year we're having this conversation about the wage bill, but we never managed to get into that conversation properly to look at actually what it actually means. Are there consequences for labor? I'm saying first deal with the points that we're raising, and then we can talk about the labor issue, 189, 179, whatever that particular rules are that requires a whatever of the public service. You will hear that we're not even raising the issue from our perspective of restructuring, of the four R's, rationalization, restructuring, repositioning, and retrenchment. We're not even raising that because we think that it's probably politically correct to continuously speak about that because of a potential pressure on that it has on the fiscus. But we're saying let the evidence show, firstly in terms of what is the design of the state that you want. The NDP tries to deal with these matters. The question is, what is the executive branch through government going to do about it? So we're not getting into that, because the size and the shape, the structure, the resourcing of the public service needs to be looked at. And may I add, there's a history here. There's a hot spot, depending who you speak to, of 14 administrations pulled together. 14, so for those that can't remember, remember the Bantustans and the old South Africa and the TBVC areas, hot spots together. Okay? And there are reports that the late Honorable Zola Skweyiya led on how the public services will look like. If you want us, we can go dig back in that and actually bring you the lessons from there. But until then, we as the FFC, we're not on this thing that this thing is a problem. We note that it's quite high, but high against what? But also, to what extent has the public service created employment and added to growth within the country? But if you look back, if it didn't happen, we'd probably start with the revolution in 1994. So there are historic things that's biting us now, but we shouldn't forget that just because we want to deal with the present. We need to look at what is the collateral impact of those decisions taken at a certain time. On the efficiency questions, Honorable Chair, what we will do, with your permission, we'll send our paper on productivity in the public service that we have done to the continent, for the four content advisors, secretaries of your committees, for them to share with you. But in there we raise the issues on that. On the restructuring of cabinet, we're not going to give a view on that. That's not our space. In fact, you're asking us to tango in the dark. And you know what happens if you tango in the dark. You walk on somebody's feet and you hear somebody screaming. You don't know what's going on. And then they fight with you. We first need to understand what is it all about. And I think probably the whole question of freezing of the executive authority salaries is a means to get that. On SONA and MTPPS, clearly, I mean, the PPOs confirmed that by now we should have a medium-term expenditure framework, a medium-term strategic framework, the two documents, which then would have helped us to see how the future look like. What we have is a carry-through or drag-through of SONA, of the State of the Nation on the medium-term budget policy statement. We don't have a problem with that. If that's the policy trajectory that government is taking or the policy stance, our job is to help with that. A forensic audit into ESCOM, both ESCOM and ASAA? Yes. But why only the two of them? Why not focusing also on those hundreds of SOEs in provinces? That's where stuff finds, evaporates, like your computer will say to you, hibernate, evaporates, we don't know what's going on. So why not a focus on that too? But yes, we would support, if it's with the intent to make sure that we have capable SOEs, if it's the intent to reorganize SOEs, to look at the economic activity that SOEs play, then why not? Yes. On the issue of the seriousness of our recommendations, the FSC's recommendations, I think, and I want to say this, and I said this to this poll, to this committee again, the only time that people can act, the departments and the levels of government can take us serious, is when committees like this adopts or disagree, approves, disagree, and adopts the recommendations that we put in front of you. And when you have done that, it gives us the at least the leverage to then measure what has happened to our recommendations. That's the first thing. And Mayor Hasson is probably the same for our colleagues in the PBO, because I'm worried, Chairperson, that I'm sort of serving as on the FFC as a part-time person since 2013 and since 2017 June as the chairperson of it. I'm worried that we're just being called sometimes, and I'm not suggesting it's happening here, because I raised it with the Appropriations Committee and they were quite open to the comment that I made. Is it constitutional compliance? And is it the form of malicious constitutional compliance that we just get called because you need to speak to us? The Constitution requires to speak to us. But when it's done, it's done. And we am raising that because it is a serious problem. If we don't, if Parliament's committees don't want the FFC because of the issues that we raised, then it's correct. Then Parliament's committees must recommend that we change the Constitution. Otherwise, it's another waste in the system. And if our things doesn't get considered, it's a waste in the system. And that's the truth. I mean, I don't mind not having the chairperson's job, but the thing is, let's protect our constitutional structures, let's protect this institution in the interest of our future generations. Other than that, if you don't like it, let's stop it on that. But the Treasury, on behalf of government, publishes in the budget review, it's called sometimes Appendix W1, an explanatory memorandum on the division of revenue. Now, I would suggest that you find time to read through that, and then you'll see. I don't want to preempt your view on it. You can always call us back to be able to talk to it. But to say we agree on this is insufficient. It doesn't help with the policy injection. It doesn't help with changing the administration. It doesn't help with changing the fiscal arrangement and the budgeting and expenditure to it. It's insufficient. The agree is insufficient. We don't see the carry-through effect. For example, we made recommendations on the National Higher Education before fees must fall. And if those recommendations were taken into consideration by the whole of government, we would not have had a fees must fall, just for the record, because we've made those recommendations on it. On the issue of we think there are a combination of factors why we find ourselves in this situation. And I would venture to say that on the one end is the weak economy, on the other end is fiscal leakages, on the other end is on our administrative systems. It's got to do with sometimes we're hoping that it has changed, but before there was the unpatriotic behavior of business. There's collusion that has happened between business and I mean, the 2010, so lots of examples of collusion, 2010 World Cup, and it's carrying on around that. So there are a combination of factors. There's also the issue of poverty, unemployment. There are many reasons. I think the South African, I mean, if you have a clean canvas and you ask everybody to go write down without being personal about what they see is the problem, the canvas will be full within 5 years. So there are lots of things that we would say requires attention on it. Then the issue that was raised on debt relief, the point is, yes, there must be conditions, but yes, we need to look at what's the role of Parliament in it, because we're advising Parliament, and by that we're also advising the executive. There needs to be conditions for cash or equity injections. Just the rollout of what has been given to the state-owned enterprises relative to, because if you give to them, you need to cut where it actually matters, or need to go search for money like the Treasury has been doing for economic reasons, because otherwise we will have a cross-default call-up, you know. So on guarantees and on borrowing, yes, there has to be conditions, and those conditions have to be transparent. Chair, can I quickly then just ask Dr. Kay to speak to the growth projections that you raised, the big question, to Eddie on NHI, because it was a big question on NHI that was in this place that we need to fix, on the NHI and on the higher education matter. And by the way, there's no debate about investment in our young children. I mean, if it can happen from 0 to 9 immediately. I mean, when I was part of a particular organization in the 90s, we recommended to the new government that there must be investment in 0 to 9. What has happened over time? Some of you are younger and older than me, you know the story around that. But Eddie is going to respond us to that, to the K on the projections quickly. And then Sheng is just going to speak on the matter on fiscal leakages, a quick respond on that in terms of the examples asked. And Mkululi, Dr. Ngumbe, and Dr. Faku, curriculum and local government in terms of the questions asked. Okay?
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairs and Honourable Members. Quick one on the growth projections. I think the intention was highlighting from the Commission side that we see a credibility problem in terms of growth projections and projections for revenue and expenditure, which always tend to close towards the outer years, and that we never quite get there. And then in year we have the problem of having to cut revenue and then also expenditure. I don't think we were specifically proposing that the FFC should be doing the growth rate projections. However, if you look internationally, there are countries where there are independent fiscal institutions which do this. I think, obviously with my CE hat on, we probably don't have the person power currently to do such a thing ourselves, but I think the question for the country is one maybe which we should ponder upon, is to how we bring in the voices of independent fiscal institutions, perhaps not only after we have had the tabling of a budget or an MTBPS, but perhaps in the forming of the various scenarios that the Treasury would consider in setting up the one that it takes then when it pronounces on the budget for government. Obviously, various scenarios require different assumptions, and those relate then to the various areas of government expenditure, how expenditure is prioritized within government, as well as then on the revenue-raising side, including capacities of institutions and so on. So many assumptions have to be made in order to finally get to a growth projection. So perhaps, in short, we would want to consider institutionalizing a process whereby there's more consultation informing the budget and the MTBPS. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The question around free higher education, so what we're trying to highlight is not a matter of whether we need to make a choice between funding of free higher education and ECD. In fact, the ECD grant that is going to be phased into the provincial equitable share formula came as a result of the recommendations that was made by the Commission in about 4 years ago. So that is not the point. The point is that we need to have a budget that is backed by policy. So in this case, we've got the free basic higher education, which is not backed by policy, especially relating to issues like benefit limitations and actually identifying study field of priority. So we've got high levels of attrition within the free higher education system, but there is no policy that addresses the question of how to deal with the students who are not completing their studies in time. So basically, that is what we are calling for. Now, in relation to NHI, the main point, we've come to Parliament many a times highlighting the underspending that is associated with the NHI grant. And what is essentially what we are saying, those present an implementation risk. So we are most unlikely to meet the NHI implementation targets because as a result of this consistent underspending on the NHI grant. As the chairperson had mentioned, is that there's already a fear, even from the MTBBS statement made by the Minister of Finance, that we are unlikely to afford the NHI funding requirements. And we've made several recommendations again to this Parliament around the need for National Department of Health to consult more closely with the province so that the money that is being allocated to the provincial Department of Health is spent accurately and also to be finished. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Members. Okay, just to re-emphasize the issue around fiscal leakages, as our chairperson has already said, it's really about the rules and regulations governing the fiscal system or the engine or the system of the government. And in terms of the logical test to this is really, I think nobody rolls off the bed in the morning thinking, I'm going to be corrupt today, right? There has to be things lying around in the system and that no one is looking when corruption happens, and that is leakage, right? So there is things lying around it. And in terms of the specific examples in the fiscal sense, is that if you look in terms of, it's really wide-ranging, right? In the intergovernmental fiscal systems, I invite you to look into the cash balances of provinces at the end of the financial year, right? So just how much money is sitting across provinces. Even in terms of national, I think we all, and it's also explained in terms of the SOCs and so on over the past few years. So with that, I'll leave it to Dr. Ngube.
On local government, there were two issues raised. One was the source of our information on municipalities that are dysfunctional, and last year our submission was, which we've been going through it to the provinces, was on municipalities which are dysfunctional. So the source of information is our research, which is contained in the annual division of revenue on municipalities which are dysfunctional. And the other issue which was raised is the issue that there are rural municipalities which have a thin revenue base, so we should not expect much from them. The FFC accepts that there are those municipalities that have a thin revenue base, and we argue that if there are such municipalities, the purpose of the state is to support such municipalities in whatever way. The purpose of the grants is to support such municipalities which have a very thin revenue base. And the other issue which was raised was about this district model, which was said in the SONA. What we are saying that that particular model has the potential to improve coordination and planning, which are big challenges across the different spheres. Coordination is very poor, and planning is also, as some of the discussions were talking this morning about the challenge of planning. However, we're saying even if this particular model has some potential, there is need to consider the weaknesses within the local government sphere, especially within the district municipalities. 60% of these districts are dysfunctional. So we need to look into their dysfunctionality and how we can support them so that they implement this particular or carry this particular role of coordination and planning effectively. Thank you.
Thank you. I think one question that was not addressed is the one on whether the FFC has done some work on the capacity of district municipalities. In the past, we've done some work on district municipalities, but it was not necessarily on the capacity, but we looked at the relevance of districts, and what we found was that most of the local government functions are currently sitting with local municipalities, and districts are not really assisting, especially in urban areas. So the recommendation that was made was that maybe we should look into getting rid of district municipalities in urban areas and keep them in rural areas. Thanks.
Chairperson, that's all our responses.
Thank you. I'll be very short. There was a question on the macro structure. We did, in our pre-MTBPS presentation, we did a comparison about the previous structure, macro structure, and the new structure in terms of the new departments that has been gazetted. And in terms of that comparison, we found that we only reduced the macro structure by one department at this stage. But the new structure has not been implemented. I suppose the new structure will only be phased in with a new budget. But at this stage, we only reduced the structure by one department. And then in terms of whether SONA or whether the budget is aligned to SONA, we try to match all the reprioritization in the function groups with SONA, but it doesn't mean that all the actions that government is going to take will, at the end of that day, achieve what the president is actually thinking that we're going to achieve or the goals that's going to achieve. So those are the things that needs to be monitored carefully and make sure that there are the correct performance indicators and targets set in annual performance plans to try and monitor whether we're really going to reach those goals that the President set for the second priority. In terms of NHI, we did a summary of the NHI bill. I think one should have a broader discussion on the NHI, because if we don't have money to implement the entire NHI and to create the National Health Insurance Fund, which is basically proposed by the bill that has been tabled, one must decide whether we want to split the bill just to get ready for NHI before we basically create the fund. But I think that's a broader discussion that the committees can have in terms of the NHI, because at this stage we don't have enough funding to roll out the total NHI, because we don't have the funds to improve the health system of the public sector. We need a lot of money to get to a standard to be able to roll out a national health system.
Thank you. There were a few questions from at least three MPs and one response from the FFC with respect to the accuracy of National Treasury's forecast. The Parliamentary Budget Office has been looking at the accuracy of Treasury's forecast since its inception. We've completed three reports looking at forecast accuracy, but what's important of here to note is that, as members have noted, it's critical for forecasts to be as accurate as possible without there being any biasness in the forecast. Accurate forecasts and unbiased forecasts allow for proper fiscal planning, and it builds credibility, and these are quite important. At the same time, it's important to note that these are just forecasts. I mean, forecasts are an accurate, informed guess about the future. And by nature, I mean, you can't know the future. You can estimate, you can make some assumptions that are reasonable, but the future is uncertain. A famous economist called John Kenneth Galbraith says that economists do forecasts to make soothsaying seem respectful. So the point is, it's inherently uncertain. All of that said, though, our reports and our findings have shown National Treasury's forecasts compared to other comparator organizations to be as accurate and sometimes over certain horizons more accurate. So what's important to look at over here are the numbers. So if you look at, this is essentially called a root mean square error. It's an assessment, it's an estimate of the assessment of the accuracy of National Treasury's forecast. What you're looking for over here is the smallest number as possible. And if you look at some of the horizons, Treasury is quite close to the average and sometimes even lower than the average. And that, in terms of overall accuracy, is good. However, that's not to say that these forecasts can't be more accurate. And there is potential for herding in terms of accuracy when you look at the forecasts of other organizations. So in essence, there may actually be potential for additional accuracy. And at this point in time, based on our data set, which spans 22 years, there's no strong reason upon which to conclude overall biasness. And so our four reports are available. That said, there was discussion about, you know, independent fiscal institutions doing independent forecasts outside of the government, and that's the case in the UK with the OBR doing that. It is a very resource-intensive program, and this, I mean, exists as an option for any government. There was another point about why are growth forecasts so inaccurate, but fiscal metrics such as expenditure more accurate. Government has a direct lever over expenditure. So government plans expenditure based on revenue, and therefore it's something that's within the ambit of government's control. Growth is somewhat endogenous, but largely exogenous, and hence you find large revisions to growth forecasts and revenue forecasts, which depend on exogenous factors. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. Just want a quick one on the ESCOM question of the classification of the support into debt versus equity. I think strangely we had a chat about it during our brainstorm. What does that mean? I mean, from the investor point of view, if you're putting money into an entity,
as a debt, you're somehow, you know, able to get your value back. You know, if you borrow somebody, you expect them to pay you back interest at least. So if you classify it as a debt, you know, when there is issues, I mean, when you have to, you know, pay your costs as a debtor, your interest becomes the important part of it. So if you classify it as debt, you probably expect to get some value from it than when you classify it as equity. Because as equity, when there is no money to pay dividends, you're not going to pay dividends if in a hypothetical thinking. So, yeah, I mean, that's how one way of thinking about it. You can get value as government from that debt if you classify it as debt, as opposed to classify it as equity. But of course, it's clearly, you know, complicated, as simple as I put it in the ESCOM situation. But I mean, just giving us a hypothetical response there. I mean, just a quick point on wage bill. I think what we were trying to put up, I think the chair of the FFC has largely touched some of the issues. But I think the point we're making is, there is a need, Chair, of really having strategic discussions around the wage bill. I looked at our 2018 MTPS presentation. We know there was wage bill as well, issue as well. I know over the previous years it has been, but there hasn't been a clear strategic direction in terms of how we want to take it. But I think last year we had certainly looked at, you don't want to put the horse before the cart, as the chair was saying now, the FFC, where you need to decide what kind of structure you want to have or what kind of government services you want to have, and then you can decide in terms of what numbers you want to have, as opposed to the other way around, where you cut without necessarily having that. I think that's the point that we've said last year, and I think what we're putting as well now is some of the more implications for wider public finances, to say, if you decrease the spending, you likely to affect your revenue focus. Of course, we did not have specific numbers in terms of how much does the public sector contribute. There's a quite concerted consistency in terms of the public sector contribution into the revenue, government revenue, and it's easy to trace and it's easy to get it, you know, compared to other taxes and so on. And I mean, that's in a sense what you're saying. We need to have that conversation more strategically and you know, informing the way forward, and which has not happened in as far as we look at the conversations from government's perspective. The other point was on infrastructure, which also was a point that was discussed in our MTPS last year. Nearly, I just checked that it was there. It's a very important aspect, and I think there are two slides that Honourable Ryder refers to. It's tried to say, you know, even if you want to spend infrastructure, which, you know, the expectations that the multipliers there are more significant than not spending or relocating, there are issues within both metros, you know, poor planning, you know, non-compliance of learning provisions, lack of monitoring and evaluations, or monitoring and supervision of the project, and which is quite a lot of list. And I think what we're also trying to find is, look into those things as well as part of the side to say, how does the parliament, what is the parliament's role in that regard, and how does it continuously require all spheres of government to look into those as a matter of realizing the importance of infrastructure spending on service delivery, but also on you know, supporting the economic growth in this regard. There were specific questions on work done in terms of local government or structures or entities, whether other entities needs to be you know, matched with others and so on. I think we have not done that, Honourable Abraham, but I think that's why we're here as this people. We're here to support you, the committees, or if there is any specific issue that you'd like us to look at, you know, you just send us a request from the committee and we can look into that. I think that's essentially what I wanted to cover. Siraj, thanks.
Thank you, Chair. The first one is just to clarify, there were questions when I was presenting, I spoke about labour market regulation and competition, etc.
just to clarify that, that was in the context of looking at constraints to achieving the sectoral goals listed in the National Treasury's paper. And it was in the context of continued distrust and the huge ideological divide across stakeholders and interest groups in South Africa because of the extreme inequality within the country. And to say, on these kinds of areas, you know, we've had a history of not being able to come to agreement, and we've even got certain institutions and organizations like NEDLAC and other, and we've got the Competition Commission, but even then, it's been really hard to actually take forward and build on this. And so these are things that we've been working on, that we have to keep working on, but I don't think that we're going to see necessarily the kind of contributions to growth in the medium or even longer than medium term to that we would hope for if we were focusing only on the sectoral and not on the macroeconomic. The second issue was one of the members expressed surprise that we were talking about fiscal stimulus when we have a 6.5% debt to GDP deficit. And just to talk through that, you know, and also the honourable member was saying that, well, if we're talking about infrastructure, that's good, but it's been crowded out by consumption spending. Now, I'm just trying to think about how to express this. You know, we see that people like to talk about microeconomic and sectoral issues, but they don't like to talk about macroeconomics. And one of the reasons is that I don't think it's something that comes naturally to people, right? We use GDP as the measure of how the economy is performing. But, you know, if we have a natural disaster and we fix up things after the natural disaster, that money gets added to GDP. When there's fiscal leakage, when there's corruption, you know, the people making money out of that are spending money, and that goes towards GDP growth. So GDP isn't necessarily only a positive measure of what's good in the economy. And then we use other factors to say, well, what is our debt-to-GDP ratio, right? And so in thinking about broadly about macroeconomics, an increase in expenditure by government, whether there's fiscal leakage, whether there's corruption, whether we don't build the infrastructure we say we're spending on, that money actually does contribute to GDP in the short term. And so I'm not saying that's good. I'm saying that as PBO, as FFC, as members of parliament, we actually need to monitor and make sure that in the long run or the medium term that expenditure actually does go towards improving the conditions in the economy as redistributive qualities, etc., that money gets efficiently spent. But in just from a broad, simple accounting identity version of macroeconomics, that contributes to GDP growth. Now, the issue then is, what happens, and the question is, so what if we've got a 6.5% debt to GDP level, right? Continued fiscal consolidation, and this is acknowledged we mentioned in the 2017 MTBPBS, it's actually touched on in the current MTBPBS, it hasn't contributed to being able to bring down the debt to GDP level. And the debt to GDP level is a ratio. It's debt over GDP. What happens when GDP goes up? Your debt to GDP ratio goes down if your debt stays the same. What's been happening in South Africa is that our GDP has not been performing and our debt has been kept going up. And we're not addressing the question of what is going to make GDP, especially in the MTEF period, go up. And that is really important. And we can think about that. Now, within macroeconomics, there's this idea of a fiscal multiplier. Because government, and you've probably heard people say this before, and people often say glibly, but government is different to our household. The way we manage our finances has to be different because we are different. Because when government spends, That money goes into the economy and it promotes other activities within the economy and allows the economy to perform directly, but also through improving conditions in the economy, through building infrastructure, through educating people, through making sure that people are more healthy, through helping people who can't afford food to get food. The government spending goes into all those things. So when we talk about government consumption, people think it's just consuming and we're wasting, right? But it's an investment as well. And so when we think about the fiscal multiplier, you know, it's often a number that economists will calculate and do lots of technical work to do, but I think as government, as the executive, but also as members of parliament, you can actually contribute to saying, well, what aspects of the economy can we spend on that will make the fiscal multiplier larger and larger? You know, there's huge over there's overcapacity in industry. We've you know, if you look at manufacturing, we have only 80% of capacity being used at the moment, and even though we've got very high unemployment. We've got very high unemployment levels. We've got all kinds of places that we can spend in the short term that may actually increase and use the fiscal multiplier as a policy variable rather than just something that you calculate after the fact. So this issue of, you know, is there fiscal space has to be taken into account, I think, that kind of broader macroeconomic discussion. I know that we're all scared of debt. I'm very scared of debt. At a personal level, in my household, I'm really scared of debt. But even for government, knowing these things from a macroeconomic perspective, I am scared of debt. But there are things that we should be doing at a macroeconomic level in terms of thinking about government's expenditure and government's expenditure ceilings that's really important. And for this reason, I'm also really concerned about us talking about taking fiscal rules further, because we need to actually do things on a case-to-case basis, and these things are time dependent. You know, after the global financial crisis, we needed to stimulate the economy. We actually didn't bring down interest rates, and there wasn't an adequate stimulus of the economy. And those two things, you know, probably, the chair of the FSC was talking about their report on higher education and avoiding the fees must fall problem. You know, we may have been able, if we had done that spending then, we may actually not be in the level of debt we are now. But also, the sharp decrease in debt from through the 2000s may have actually been too much. It may have actually been too much of a constraint on the economy, and that's something we don't talk about as well. I'm worried I'm sort of going to go into too much detail here, but I think when thinking about the fiscal stimulus and fiscal contraction, we need to actually, I think, start thinking much more from a macro perspective and what works and what doesn't work within specific time frames of budgets. And we're not doing, I think, enough of that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Those are the responses. But Professor Plakis, there's something I didn't understand. Are you insinuating that Parliament or Treasury does not take FFC recommendations serious? There's something that you said in relation to FFC status, because FFC derives its existence from the Constitution and an Act of Parliament. Can you clarify yourself so that we don't leave with statements which are not clear? Maybe you were a bit emotional. And can you calm down and make it very clear what message were you putting across?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm never emotional. I'm always excited about what I say. And I get carried away with what I say. Let me respond to you directly. The annually, we make a number of recommendations. In fact, we make one recommendation, which is constitutional, on the submission and the division of revenue to Parliament. For the last five parliaments, also in the six parliaments, so every year since, probably since 1996.
I mean, I'm not part of a district, but I'm talking from 2013 in particular. We've made recommendations. And what happens is that parliaments across the country, your parliament, NGOP, NA, the provincial legislatures, ask us the same question. What is the impact of the FFC's recommendations? And then we say, okay, good question. We will only know that when we know whether Parliament's committees has considered, agreed, and approved whatever recommendations we make, approve those recommendations. And based on that, we will be able to track through the budgets of departments, through the budgets of provinces, whether our recommendations has been considered. We do the same when it comes to the votes and some of the stuff which we never should be asked by some other parliamentary committee. I mean, the four of these committees are actually our committees. We need to speak to you. But when we get asked also by the other committees, so we make like definitive recommendations based on our constitutional responsibilities. When you see the outcomes of it, you will just see a 1, 2, 3 pages that the FFC has also made recommendations, the PPO has also made recommendations. You don't see those recommendation takes the net effect, either through, after consideration, because we also can't tell you what to do, either through a motion of Parliament or through a change or amendment in an appropriate piece of legislation. You don't see that. Okay? So based on that, because you have robust conversations with us, you ask us the right questions on behalf of the citizens of the country. But after that, it was just another conversation that we had based on our constitutional responsibility. And hence I'm asking the question, because I'm wanting to lift the level of conversation here. Is it because it's a constitutional compliance matter and a legislative compliance matter that we get asked to come and present to Parliament, which makes it sort of almost at the edge of making it malicious compliance, complying for the sake of compliance, right? And I'm not talking about this Parliament, because I've got great hope for this Parliament. In fact, I've got great hope for the Appropriations Committee, how they interact with us on these matters. It's the carry-through of the stuff. Successive, yes. And then what we see then in the, sometimes 2, 3 years down the line, aye, but we told these people these things, but they never took us serious. When it comes to the Treasury, I'm saying to the Honourable Chairpersons and the Honourable Members that Treasury every year respond on behalf of the Executive to our recommendations, to our submission. And they also respond to an appropriation bill. Sometimes they give us the appropriation bill very late, and the division of revenue very late. And they also break the law, because the law is very clear. It's 15 days before budget day. Okay? We don't get it in time, and that's a matter that we're resolving with the Treasury. So the Treasury responds, and it's in an annexure in the book called Budget Review, which also is one of those door stoppers that the Minister of Finance tables on budget day, those green documents, the budget review. In that budget review, on annexure W1, you'll see the government's response, the executive's response to FFC recommendations. Okay? Now, taking both together, Chairperson, it then becomes the responsibility of Parliament and its committees to see exactly what we have recommended to you to be on the lookout for as the public representatives and relative to the Division of Revenue recommendations. I've never had in any of the finance committees, I'm not talking about Sixth Parliament, any of the finance committees bringing together the Division of Revenue Bill, the Appropriation Bill, our division of revenue recommendations, because we're giving it to you 9 months before the, for it, because it gives birth the next year. Okay, if 9 months is the trend to go. Some people say it's 10 months before you give birth, but 10 months, all right? So we give it to you, and then on budget day, we then have the three sets of documents, and there's a comparison between it. So you can actually see what we have recommended in terms of the division of revenue, and what is in the appropriation bill, and what is in the division of revenue bill. That's where the seriousness comes in. And it's got to do with that. And when we appear before committees, they ask us issues around taxing. The issue around VAT came up. And we said, but we made recommendations 2 or 3 years ago around the whole issue about VAT and the problems with further taxing in the system. So it's that type of things that I'm referring to. So I'm imploring on you, I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you to put a standard of measure into Parliament, Parliament's finance committees, that says, you're going to look at this, where are the treasury, where's the FFC's recommendations? What is the rationale for accepting or not accepting these recommendations? And then you can ask us, are our recommendations considered, and is there an impact? Until then, we don't know, Chairperson. And I hope that's not emotional, but it's as factual. I mean, I come from the town, so we get excited, we just speak, raise our voice, and we don't mean any emotional intent to it. But that's the way that I would suggest Parliament's committees look at it. And on the basis of that, when you ask us next year, are your recommendations considered? Then we can say to you, if you look at these following budgets of departments, it's not. Because on infrastructure growth, we made specific recommendations on the financing and what needs to be dealt with, and what are the policy questions. On rural and rurality, we raised those questions about the land questions, the eviction of people, and how things need to be happened around that. On urban and urbanization, we raised the issues around the Eskom and electricity stuff. So that's what we did, Chairperson.
Can we ask this, Prof?
Yes. Come on.
I've never seen and listened to him glossing so nice over issues, running away from bottom line. I'm asking him because we asked this question before. When we wanted to make a comparison and contrast between the two offices, Prof is just shying away from saying we have a responsibility as the committees to ensure that they get the fair share, not to be equated or to be equaled to the BTO, because they are a constitutional structure with a mandate, clear mandate. Because what he is supposed to be saying to us, if he was unequivocal as I am, would be to say, by arrangement which we know, if any structure of government or parliament is to take whatever recommendation that they have said, that they have raised outside, that should have been in writing, arguing facts as to why is this particular FFC recommendation not considered. But now, as he says, what usually happens is you don't get that documentation either from Parliament or from government with National Treasury, which says we are not going to consider this particular recommendation. But in terms of application, in terms of action, you don't realize such recommendations implemented. This is what he should have told us. But now he's, you know, crossing over issues and taking grounds and all that. Thanks, Chair.
It's called diplomacy. Quite the problem.
No. Prof, I think it's your understanding of the attitude of Parliament to FFC is not what you believe. This Parliament respects the constitutional provision
When I was a member of the Appropriations Committee, FFC made lots of recommendations. I remember Honorable Pinky Posa was the chairperson. And we factored those recommendations in our report to the chamber, to parliament. So I don't know where you get this thing that you come here and we listen to you, and then when you leave here, we don't take your recommendations. We can't write it as it is, that according, we are not writing an academic document. Or as Professor Plakis says, in bracket, in inverted commas, and then we write the source at the end. We don't write parliamentary reports like academic documents. Yes. Study our BRRR reports. They factor in some of the recommendations that come from public hearings, that come from institutions which are independent from us. But we can't, out of 20 recommendations, keep on citing a reference. We don't cite references. It's your terrain, you are a professor, you know what I mean. When you write an academic document and when you write a parliamentary document. So with my experience from the legislature where I was some years ago and here, as far as I know, we take recommendations of all the organs of state, including institutions that support democracy, very, very serious. And they are factored if you look at the reports that are presented and debated in parliament. So I think you should rest assured. Can we move? There is one item before we go to lunch. Honorable Red.
Sorry, Chairperson, I don't mean to take us backwards, but I think it's important for us to consider the inputs of the other members. And I think that the document that the FFC put together on the DORA was presented to us several weeks ago. And I think there was a lot of information that came to us, and there was a lot of agreement on many issues, and there was disagreement on other issues. However, on the sidelines of a subsequent meeting with Treasury, Treasury said that they disagree totally with the FFC's position on local government and the funding. And I think that what's important is that as committees, we then ask Treasury to comment on that document as well. Because obviously there's more than one side to an argument. And rather than wait for the budget to come to us, I think that we actually need to ask Treasury, if you disagree and you're prepared to say in an Appropriations Committee meeting that you disagree with the FFC's document, come and motivate to us. And I think that's the responsibility of these committees that we sit in here, is to take inputs from all sides and make sure that we're considering it. Because it's pointless to get a lovely document, which I agreed with large parts of it from the FFC, and then we wait and the next thing we get is a budget, and by which time it's too late to take it further. So my recommendation is that, Chair, please, at a date not too far in the distant future, that we get a presentation from Treasury in response to that. Thank you.
Yes, be that as it may, it is Parliament at the end which appropriate a budget. So Treasury can have their own views as an organ of state or as a department. But at the end, it's us who take a report to the chamber and appropriate budget, go through each vote, and take a decision at the end. So, as I've said, we take all the views very serious. And at that time when we meet Treasury, they will have to explain to us why, what is their attitude towards a constitutional structure. Because FFC is not just a structure which has been established by an act, but it has been established by a constitution. So we'll deal with those issues. We wanted to clear that, honorable members and members of FFC and PBO. Thanks very much, FFC, PBO, and other officials are released. We can remain with those that... HR and others, so that we can deal with the advert for PBO. Thanks very much.
Otherwise, Parliament closes.
Can we move to item 6, approval of advert, PBO director. You remember when we met the other time at the, was it Max Building? We appointed a subcommittee, and amongst other responsibilities of the subcommittee was to generate an advert for a PBO. Before you, amongst the documents that you have got a one-page document entitled Parliamentary Budget Office Director. Cost to the package, they earn more than a member of parliament. So, Knox, you can apply. And the Minister of Finance will call you a millionaire. Key performance areas and all those. I'm not sure if whether Human Resource wants to speak to this or the document speaks for itself. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chairperson, for that. I discussed it with my colleagues. The Act says that the committees themselves must recommend the appropriate salary and benefits for the director. And it's based on its experience or his or her experience and qualifications. I'll just read you the section in section 15. It says the respective houses, you must make the recommendations and you must appoint a fit and proper person with the necessary skills and leadership, and then at sub B, subsection 5, B must determine the conditions of service, including the salary and allowance of the director, which must take into account the knowledge and experience of the person and be substantially the same as those in the top rank of public service. So I assume that that's the amount on the advert is the top rank of public service, but Chair, depending on exactly how the committees want to deal with it, one can just put it that it is more or less, or it's in that band of $2 million per annum, and then there's a scope for some negotiation. I don't know if HR, or if it's, I almost want to say if it naturally flows from these kind of appointment processes in terms of HR that there is that negotiation, then it's fine. But I think the candidates need to also know that it can be a little bit lower or higher depending on how the committees view their knowledge and experience as per the Act. Thank you, Chair. That's all I wanted to bring to the attention of the committees.
Okay. Thanks, HR.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and good afternoon to Honourable Members. I thought maybe let me just clarify that the Advocate Jenkins is correct. Let me just clarify that the amount as you have it on the advert. Honourable Members will remember that to date the administration has been supporting the Budget Office in terms of HR processes. So even with regards to the salary bands, we've been using the salary bands in the administration. So basically the amount that you see there, that is the minimum of the for the position of the director where it was evaluated at. It was evaluated at parliamentary administration level E3, and the minimum salary cost to company for E3 is that 2,031,591 rand. The maximum is 2,133,168 rand. Now, Advocate Jackie is correct. That amount is actually in line with the amounts in the public service at a DG level, which is level 16. The minimum currently in terms of total package in the minimum for the Director General is 1,978,533, excluding the 10% head of department allowance. If you add that in, it comes to 2,176,386. So it's in the same category as the highest level in the public service in terms of DG levels. Thank you, Chair. Honorable Chair.
So I'm opening up. How much does the Secretary of Parliament earn?
The salary for the Secretary of Parliament is 2,956,183.
Just wanted to have an idea of what we are dealing with here. Okay, members, that's the presentation. Key performance, they are there. Qualification, master's or related PhD. Minimum experience, 10 years relevant. Analyst or researcher, 2 years at senior management level. And the skills requirements are all those that are there. Then fit and proper, I think it's a constitutional requirement. We don't want an insane person to be because you come and say all sorts of things that we don't understand. The closing date is the 22nd of November, and then Parliament down there is Parliament describe itself, what is it all about? Any comment from Comrade John?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chairperson, looking at the document and all aspects that needed for the mentioned position, I think it's covering everything. So I would propose that we adopt the advert.
There is a mover for the adoption of the outfit, Noxie, then Mahoshi.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. Maybe let me also confirm that we did have, as the small committee, we did have a meeting with Human Resource and went through the advert. The only outstanding question for me, as I second the proposal to adopt, is whether, according to the discussions that we had in that meeting, the advert did go out. Because seeing that the closing date is the 22nd, we said at least a minimum of 2 weeks should have it out there. Is it out?
So you have sent the advert to the newspapers. So what do you want us to do here? Oh, okay, I thought you said the advert is already out. Okay. Mahosh, Dikhal.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I was raising my hand in order to support what the Honorable Member was saying and also to propose closure because the bells are ringing. Thanks.
Second, Mahosh, well, I'm seconding. The proposal. The other thing will come from the chair. Comrade.
Thanks, Chair. It's good that the other thing will come from you because I was to talk on the time frame of the advert. Then we're leaving it with you.
Okay. There's no objection. Because the Buteles, you can consider applying. I'm meaning the money. And get somebody to act Lapo Mesabatin for 5 years. Okay, thanks very much, honorable members. The meeting is adjourned.